Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Jackie Judd. Every now and then, a novel transcends its time. Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man is such a book. Published in 1952, when segregation was the law of the land, it told the story of one black man's encounter with America. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the publication of Invisible Man, and recognition is taking a number of forms, including a documentary, which will be broadcast tomorrow night on PBS. NPR's Lynn Neary explores the legacy of Ralph Ellison and his novel.
All great novels begin the same way, with a great opening sentence.
I am an invisible man.
With those words, a unique character was introduced to the world of American literature. Other African-American writers, like Richard Wright, author of Native Son, had already created powerful black characters. But Avon Kirkland says Invisible Man went beyond anything that had preceded it. Kirkland wrote and produced the PBS documentary Ralph Ellison, An American Journey.
This was a highly conscious, highly intelligent, highly articulate character. Before that, black characters in American fiction tended to be two-dimensional, stereotypical victims, not agents of their own change.
Young, black, and nameless, the Invisible Man's journey begins at his grandfather's deathbed, moves to the campus of a black college in the rural South, and ends in Harlem. Each person he meets along the way, both black and white, imposes an identity on him of their own making, and each identity strips him of his own true sense of self. The PBS documentary dramatizes key passages from the book.
I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me. When they approach me, they see only my surroundings, themselves, or a figment of their imagination. Indeed, everything and anything but me.
What did I do to be so black and blue?
Clyde Taylor, who teaches film and literature at New York University, was an undergraduate student at Howard University when Invisible Man was first published in 1952.
It had an enormous impact on me and my fellow students because it seemed to speak to our situation.
In 1952, says Taylor, the situation was this, a seething anger over life in a segregated world, but at the same time, a growing awareness that things were changing.
We knew it had to change. We knew we were the proof that it had to change. Because if you remember, this was a time when modern jazz had taken off, the music we call bebop, and bebop said, we cannot be contained. That's what that music was saying. So Ellison, I think, his book comes out at a point almost at the crest of this moment of self-awakening.
Ellison, a trained musician, brought the improvisational quality of jazz to his writing, taking his hero through a series of situations that provided an insight into the way it felt to be black in America. At the same time, Ellison drew upon his own study of novelists such as Dostoevsky to create a classic story of a young man on a journey of self-awareness. Time and again, his hero is betrayed by those he had come to trust, from the black president of his college to the white leaders of a communist-like organization called the Brotherhood. Finally, he literally retreats to try and make sense of all he has experienced.
And now I realized that I couldn't return to Mary's or to any part of my old life. I could approach it only from the outside, and I had been as invisible to Mary as I had been to the Brotherhood. No, I couldn't return to Mary's, or to the campus, or to the Brotherhood, or home. I could only move ahead or stay here, underground. So I would stay here until I was chased out. Here, at least, I could try to think things out in peace, or if not in peace, in quiet. I would take up residence underground. The end was in the beginning.
Invisible Man was extraordinarily well received when it was published in 1952 and won the National Book Award the following year. But in the 1960s, Ellison's work came under attack. The book was criticized for not being a protest novel. His character's decision to go underground and write a book was deemed a weak response to the discrimination he had experienced. Ellison himself was accused of being an Uncle Tom. Documentary producer Avon Kirkland.
He was attacked in the mid-1960s and onward for a few years, and very strongly by proponents of black nationalism. Ellison's critics felt that the character should have reacted to what had happened to him by becoming very, very militant, and Ellison was taken to task for that choice.
I personally feel that Ellison is an example of kind of a crucified black malehood in America.
Novelist Walter Mosley was in college in the 1970s when he read Invisible Man. Mosley went on to create his own Invisible Man, the detective E.Z. Rollins, a character, says Mosley, who uses invisibility as a tool. Mosley says he was free to create such a character, whereas Ellison labored under a burden of almost impossible expectations.
Coming out of that period in the 40s and the 50s, where black people wanted more than anything to be seen as equal human beings in the world, it hamstrung him in a way. You know, writing wasn't just fun. It wasn't just, well, I'm writing because I love to write and I want to put out a good book and it'll be fun. You know, he would be, I have to put out the best book. I have to do the greatest writing. And succeeded. But I feel like it hurt him more than it helped him.
Ellison was never able to finish another novel. He lost 350 pages of a draft of his second novel in a fire and never recovered. But he worked continuously, writing thousands of pages that were edited into the novel Juneteenth after his death in 1994. A perfectionist, Ellison worked on the language of his characters by reading into a tape recorder.
They cut out our tongues. Lord, they left us without words. Amen. They scattered our tongues in this land like seed, and they left us without language. They took away our talking drums. Drums that talk, Daddy Hickman? Tell us about those talking drums. Drums that talk like a telegraph. Drums that could reach across the country like a church bell sound.
For young African-American writers like Kenji Jasper, Invisible Man is as important now as it was 50 years ago, and the criticism that surfaced in the 60s is no longer relevant. Now, Jasper says, the novel can be seen for what it is.
It's about identity. You know, I honestly believe that when Ellison wrote it, one of his main points was about racial identity, but it was about coming to a point when none of the options work. You know, there are no doors that will take you to your destination. So effectively, if you want to find happiness, if you want to find peace, you have to make a door for yourself. And that can be applied on a lot of different levels, not just racial. Your politics, your sense of family, you know, invisibility runs the gamut as far as the way it can be interpreted.
It seems, says Jasper, that some of the questions raised by Invisible Man are yet to be answered, and that, he says, makes him wish that Ellison had written more. Perhaps, Jasper says, a writer of his generation will pick up where Ralph Ellison left off. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Context of White Supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, May 25th, 2018. So I have been told. This is our fourth study session on Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, again, in Gus's top five all time, one of my favorite books. I think a lot of constructive information about the system of white supremacy. We're picking up on chapter six. Again, this book, they do not announce the chapter breaks, so you just have to be alert when you hear a significant pause before our narrator, Mr. Morton, begins again. Probably a chapter break. That said, we're picking up after Reverend Barbie's lengthy sermon about the school lore last week. Our main character is about to meet Dr. Bledsoe and find out what his fate is going to be. Will there be any ramifications for the problems he had chauffeuring Mr. Norton? The audio segment that you heard, that's from NPR 2002 during the 50-year anniversary of Invisible Man. I thought very significant that Ellison was, I guess, widely thought of as an Uncle Tom during the 50s, 60s height of what they call the civil rights movement. Maybe something to keep in mind and ponder as we read. Again, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, Context of White Supremacy. This is chapter six.
Down the sloping lawn below me, the male students moved toward their dormitories, seeming far away from me now, remote, and each shadowy form vastly superior to me, who had by some shortcoming cast myself into the darkness away from all that was worthwhile and inspiring. I listened to one group harmonize quietly as they passed. The smell of the fresh bread being prepared in the bakery drifted to me. The good white bread of breakfast, the rolls dripping with yellow butter that I had slipped into my pocket so often to be munched later in my room with wild blackberry jam from home. Lights began to appear in the girls' dormitories, like the bursting of luminous seeds flung broadside by an invisible hand. Several cars rolled by. I saw a group of old women who lived in the town approaching. One used a cane, which from time to time she tapped hollowly upon the walk like a blind man. Snatches of their conversation flooded to me as they discussed Barbie's talk with enthusiasm, recalled the times of the founder, their quavering voices weaving and embroidering his story. Then, down the long avenue of trees, I saw the familiar Cadillac approaching and started inside the building, suddenly filled with panic. I hadn't gone two steps before I turned and hurried out into the night again. I couldn't stand to face Dr. Bledsoe immediately. I was fairly shivering as I fell in behind a group of boys going up the drive. They were arguing some point heatedly, but I was too agitated to listen and simply followed in their shadows, noticing the dull gleam of their polished shoe leather in the rays of the street lamps. I kept trying to formulate what I would say to Dr. Bledsoe, and the boys must have turned into their building, for suddenly finding myself outside the gates of the campus and heading down the highway, I turned and ran back to the building. When I went in, he was wiping his neck with a blue-bordered handkerchief. The shaded lamp, catching the lenses of his glasses, left half of his broad face in the shadow as his clenched fists stretched full forth in the light before him. I stood, hesitating in the door, aware suddenly of the old, heavy furnishings, the relics from the times of the founder, the framed portrait photographs and relief plaques of presidents and industrialists, men of power, fixed like trophies or heraldic emblems upon the walls. "Come in," he said from the half-shadow. Then I saw him move and his head coming forward, his eyes burning. He began mildly, as if quietly joking, throwing me off balance. "Boy," he said, "I understand that you not only carried Mr. Norton out to the quarters, but that you wound up at that sinkhole, that golden day." It was a statement, not a question. I said nothing, and he looked at me with the same mild gaze. Had Barbie helped Mr. Norton soften him? "No," he said. "It wasn't enough to take him to the quarters. You had to make the complete tour to give him the full treatment. Was that it?"
"No, sir. I mean that he was ill, sir," I said. "He had to have some whiskey."
"And that was the only place you knew to go," he said. "So you went there because you were taking care of him?"
"Yes, sir."
"And not only that," he said in a voice that both mocked and marveled, "you took him out and sat him down on the gallery, veranda, piazza, whatever they call it nowadays, and introduced him to the quality."
"Quality?" I frowned. Oh, but he insisted that I stop, sir. There was nothing I could do.
Of course, he said, of course.
He was interested in the cabin, sir. He was surprised that there were any left.
So naturally you stopped, he said, bowing his head again.
Yes, sir.
Yes, and I suppose the cabin opened up and told its life history and all the choice gossip.
I started to explain.
Boy, he exploded, are you serious? Why were you out there on the road in the first place? Weren't you behind the wheel?
Yes, sir.
Then haven't we bowed and scraped and begged and lied enough decent homes and drives for you to show them? Did you think that white man had to come 1,000 miles all the way from New York and Boston and Philadelphia just for you to show him a slum? Don't just stand there. Say something.
But I was only driving him, sir. I only stopped there after he ordered me to.
Ordered you, he said. He ordered you? Damn it, white folk are always giving orders. It's a habit with them. Why didn't you make an excuse? Couldn't you say they had a sickness, smallpox, or picked another cabin? Why, that True Blood shack. My God, boy, you're black and living in the South. Did you forget how to lie?
Lie, sir? Lie to him? Lie to a trustee, sir? Me?
He shook his head with a kind of anguish. And me thinking I'd picked a boy with a brain, he said. Didn't you know you were endangering the school?
But I was only trying to please him.
Please him? And here you are, junior in college. Why, the dumbest black bastard in the cotton patch knows that the only way to please a white man is to tell him a lie. What kind of education are you getting around here? Who really told you to take him out there? He said.
He did, sir. No one else.
Don't lie to me. That's
the truth, sir.
I warn you now. Who suggested it?
I swear, sir, no one told me.
Nigger, this isn't the time to lie. I'm no white man. Tell me the truth.
It was as though he'd struck me. I stared across the desk thinking, he called me that?
Answer me, boy!
That? I thought, noticing the throbbing of a vein that rose between his eyes, thinking, he called me that? I wouldn't lie, sir, I said.
Then who was that patient you were talking with?
I never saw him before, sir.
What was he saying?
I can't recall at all, I muttered. The man was raving.
Speak up. What did he say?
He thinks that he lived in France and that he's a great doctor.
Continue.
He said that I believed that White was right, I said.
What?
Suddenly his face twitched and cracked like the surface of dark water.
And you do, don't you?
Dr. Bledsoe said, suppressing a nasty laugh.
Well, don't you?
I did not answer, thinking, you? You?
Who was he? Did you ever see him before?
No, sir, I hadn't.
Was he northern or southern?
I don't know, sir. He struck his desk.
College for Negroes. Boy, what do you know other than how to ruin an institution in half an hour that it took over 50 years to build? Did he talk northern or southern?
He talked like a white man, I said, except that his voice sounded southern, like one of ours.
I'll have him investigated, he said. A Negro like that should be under lock and key.
Across the campus, a clock struck the quarter hour, and something inside me seemed to muffle its sound. I turned to him desperately. Dr. Bledsoe, I'm awfully sorry. I had no intention of going there, but things just got out of hand. Mr. Norton understands how it happened.
Listen to me, boy, he said loudly. Norton is one man and I'm another, and while he might think he's satisfied, I know that he isn't. Your poor judgment has caused this school incalculable damage. Instead of uplifting the race, you've torn it down.
He looked at me as though I had committed the worst crime imaginable.
Don't you know we can't tolerate such a thing? I gave you an opportunity to serve one of our best white friends, a man who could make your fortune, but in return you drag the entire race into the slime.
Suddenly he reached for something beneath a pile of papers, an old leg shackle from slavery, which he proudly called a symbol of our progress.
You've got to be disciplined, boy, he said. There's no ifs and ands about it.
But you gave Mr. Norton your word.
Don't stand there and tell me what I already know. Regardless of what I said, as the leader of this institution, I can't possibly let this pass. Boy, I'm getting rid of you.
It must have happened when the metal struck the desk, for suddenly I was leaning toward him, shouting with outrage.
I'll tell him, I said. I'll go to Mr. Norton and tell him. You've lied to both of us. What?
He said,
you have the nerve to threaten me in my own office?
I'll tell him, I screamed. I'll tell everybody. I'll fight you. I swear, I'll fight you.
Well, he said, sitting back, well, I'll be damned.
For a moment, he looked me up and down, and I saw his head go back into the shadow, hearing a high, thin sound like a cry of rage. Then his face came forward, and I saw his laughter. For an instant, I stared, then I wheeled and started for the door, hearing him sputter, "Wait, wait," behind me. I turned. He gasped for breath, propping his huge head up with his hands as tears streamed down his face.
"Come on. Come," he said, removing his glasses and wiping his eyes. "Come on, son," his voice amused and conciliatory.
It was as though I was being put through a fraternity initiation and found myself going back. He looked at me, still laughing with agony, his eyes burned.
"Boy, you are a fool," he said. "Your white folk didn't teach you anything, and your mother wit has left you cold. What has happened to you young Negroes? I thought you had caught on to how things are done down here, but you don't even know the difference between the way things are and the way they're supposed to be. My God," he gasped, "what is the race coming to? Why, boy, you can tell anyone you like. Sit down there. Sit down, sir, I say."
Reluctantly, I sat, torn between anger and fascination, hating myself for obeying.
"Tell anyone you like," he said. "I don't care. I wouldn't raise my little finger to stop you, because I don't owe anyone a thing, son." "Who? Negroes?" "Negroes don't control this school or much of anything else. Haven't you learned even that?" "No, sir, they don't control this school, nor white folk either. True, they support it, but I control it. I's big and black, and I say, yes, sir, as loudly as any burrhead when it's convenient. But I'm still the king down here. I don't care how much it appears otherwise. Power doesn't have to show off. Power is confident, self-assuring, self-starting and self-stopping, self-warming and self-justifying. When you have it, you know it. Let the Negroes snicker and the crackers laugh. Those are the facts, son. The only ones I even pretend to please are big white folk, and even those I control more than they control me. This is a power setup, son, and I'm at the controls. You think about that. When you buck against me, you're bucking against power, rich white folks' power, the nation's power, which means government power."
He paused to let it sink in, and I waited, feeling a numb, violent outrage.
"And I'll tell you something your sociology teachers are afraid to tell you," he said. "If there weren't men like me running schools like this, there'd be no South, nor North either, no. And there'd be no country, not as it is today. You think about that, son." He laughed. "With all your speech-making and studying, I thought you understood something. But you..." "All right, go ahead, C. Norton. You'll find that he wants you disciplined. He might not know it, but he does, because he knows that I know what is best for his interests. You're a black educated fool, son. These white folks have newspapers, magazines, radios, spokesmen to get their ideas across. If they want to tell the world a lie, they can tell it so well that it becomes the truth. And if I tell them that you're lying, they'll tell the world, even if you prove you're telling the truth, because it's the kind of lie they want to hear."
I heard the high, thin laugh again.
"You're nobody, son. You don't exist. Can't you see that? The white folk tell everybody what to think, except men like me. I tell them that's my life, telling white folk how to think about the things I know about. Shocks you, doesn't it? Well, that's the way it is. It's a nasty deal, and I don't always like it myself, but you listen to me. I didn't make it, and I know that I can't change it, but I've made my place in it, and I'll have every Negro in the country hanging on tree limbs by morning if it means staying where I am."
He was looking me in the eye now, his voice charged and sincere, as though uttering a confession, a fantastic revelation which I could neither believe nor deny. Cold drops of sweat moved at a glacier's pace down my spine.
"I mean it, son," he said. "I had to be strong and purposeful to get where I am. I had to wait and plan and lick around.
Yes, I had to act the nigger, he said, adding another fiery, yes. I don't even insist that it was worth it, but now I'm here, and I mean to stay. After you win the game, you take the prize and you keep it. Protect it. There's nothing else to do, he shrugged. A man gets old winning his place, son, so you go ahead. Go tell your story. Match your truth against my truth, because what I've said is the truth, the broader truth. Test it. Try it out. When I started out, I was a young fella, but I no longer listened, nor saw more than the play of light upon the metallic discs of his glasses, which now seemed to float within the disgusting sea of his words. Truth. Truth? What was truth? Nobody I knew, not even my mother, would believe me if I tried to tell them. Nor would I tomorrow, I thought, nor would I. I gazed helplessly at the grain of the desk, then passed his head to the case of loving cups behind his chair. Above the case, a portrait of the founder looked noncommittally down. Bledsoe laughed. Your arms are too short to box with me, son, and I haven't had to really clip a young Negro in years. No, he said, getting up. They haven't been so cocky as they used to. This time I could barely move. My stomach was knotted and my kidneys ached. My legs were rubbery. For 3 years I had thought of myself as a man, and here, with a few words, he'd made me as helpless as an infant. I pulled myself up. Wait, hold on a second, he said, looking at me like a man about to flip a coin. I like your spirit, son. You're a fighter, and I like that. You just lack judgment, though lack of judgment can ruin you. That's why I have to penalize you, son. I know how you feel, too. You don't want to go home to be humiliated. I understand that, because you have some vague notions about dignity. In spite of me, such notions seep in along with the gym-crack teachers and the northern-trained idealists. Yes, and you have some white folk backing you, and you don't want to face them, because nothing is worse for a black man than to be humiliated by white folk. I know all about that, too. Old Doc's been buked and scorned and all of that. I don't just sing about it in chapel. I know about it, but you'll get over it. It's foolish and expensive and a lot of dead weight. You let the white folk worry about pride and dignity. You learn where you are and get yourself power, influence, contacts with power and influential people. Then stay in the dark and use it. How long will I stand here and let him laugh at me, I thought, holding onto the back of the chair. How long? You're a nervy little fighter, son, he said. And the race needs good, smart, disillusioned fighters. Therefore, I'm going to give you a hand. Maybe you'll feel that I'm giving you my left hand after I'm struck you with my right, if you think I'm the kind of man who'd lead with his right, which I'm most certainly not. But that's all right, too. Take it or leave it. I want you to go to New York for the summer and save your pride and your money. You go there and earn your next year's fees, understand? I nodded, unable to speak, whirling about furiously within myself, trying to deal with him to fit what he was saying to what he had said. I'll give you letters to some of the school's friends to see that you get work, he said, but this time, use your judgment. Keep your eyes open. Get in the swing of things. Then if you make good, perhaps, well, perhaps, it's up to you. His voice stopped as he stood, tall and black and disc-eyed, huge. That's all, young man, he said, his tone abrupt, official. You have 2 days in which to close your affairs. 2 days? 2 days, he said. I went down the steps and up the walk in the dark, making it out of the building just before it bent me double beneath the wisteria that hung from the trees on the rope-like vines. Almost a total disembowelment, and when it paused, I looked up through the trees, arched high and cool above me to see a whirling, double-imaged moon. My eyes were out of focus. I started toward my room, covering one eye with my hand to avoid crashing into trees and lampposts projected into my path. I went on, tasting bile and thankful that it was night with no one to witness my condition. My stomach felt raw.
From somewhere across the quiet of the campus, the sound of an old guitar blues plucked from an out-of-tune piano drifted toward me like a lazy, shimmering wave, like the echoed whistle of a lonely train, and my head went over again, against a tree this time, and I could hear it splattering the flowering vines. When I could move, my head started to whirl in a circle. The day's events flowed past. True Blood, Mr. Norton, Dr. Bledsoe, and the Golden Day swept around my mind in a mad, surreal whirl. I stood in the path holding my eye and trying to push back the day, but each time I floundered upon Dr. Bledsoe's decision, it still echoed in my mind, and it was real and it was final. Whatever my responsibility was for what had occurred, I knew that I would pay for it. I knew that I would be expelled, and the very idea stabbed my insides again. I stood there on the moonlit walk trying to think ahead to its effects, imagining the satisfaction of those who envied my success, the shame and disappointment of my parents. I would never live down my disgrace. My white friends would be disgusted, and I recall the fear that hung over all those who had no protection from powerful whites. How had I come to this? I had kept unswervingly to the path placed before me, had tried to be exactly what I was expected to be, had done exactly what I was expected to do. Yet instead of winning the expected reward, here I was, stumbling along, holding on desperately to one of my eyes in order to keep from bursting out my brains against some familiar object swerved into my path by my distorted vision. And now, to drive me wild, I felt suddenly that my grandfather was hovering over me, grinning triumphantly out of the dark. I simply could not endure it. For despite my anguish and anger, I knew of no other way of living, nor other forms of success available to such as me. I was so completely a part of that existence that in the end, I had to make my peace. It was either that or admit that my grandfather had made sense, which was impossible. Though I still believed myself innocent, I saw that the only alternative to permanently facing the world of True Blood and the Golden Day was to accept the responsibility for what had happened. Somehow I convinced myself I had violated the code and thus would have to submit to punishment. Dr. Bledsoe is right, I told myself. He's right. The school and what it stands for have to be protected. There was no other way, and no matter how much I suffered, I would pay my debt as quickly as possible and return to building my career. Back in my room, I counted my savings, some $50, and decided to get to New York as quickly as possible. If Dr. Bledsoe didn't change his mind about helping me get a job, it would be enough to pay my room and board at Men's House, about which I had learned from fellows who lived there during their summer vacations. I would leave in the morning. So while my roommate grinned and mumbled unaware in his sleep, I packed my bags. Next morning I was up before the bugle sounded and already on a bench in Dr. Bledsoe's outer office when he appeared. The jacket of his blue serge suit was open, revealing a heavy gold chain linked between his vest pockets as he moved toward me with a noiseless tread. He passed without seeming to see me. Then as he reached his office door, he said, "I haven't changed my mind about you, boy, and I don't intend to." "Oh, I didn't come for that, sir," I said, seeing him turn quickly, looking down upon me, his eyes quizzical. "Very well, as long as you understand that. Come in and state your business. I have work to do." I waited before the desk, watching him place his Hamburg on an old brass hall tree. Then he sat before me, making a cage of his fingers and nodding for me to begin. My eyes burned and my voice sounded unreal. "I'd like to leave this morning, sir," I said. His eyes retreated. "Why this morning?" he said. "I gave you until tomorrow. Why the hurry?"
"It isn't hurry, sir, but since I have to leave, I'd like to get going. Staying until tomorrow won't change matters."
"No, it won't," he said. "That's good sense, and you have my permission." "And what else?"
"That's all, sir, except that I want to say that I'm sorry for what I did and that I hold no hard feelings. What I did was unintentional, but I'm in agreement with my punishment."
He touched his fingertips together, the thick fingers meeting delicately, his face without expression.
"That's the proper attitude," he said.
In other words, you don't intend to become bitter, is that it?
Yes, sir.
Yes. I can see that you're beginning to learn. That's good. Two things our people must do is accept responsibility for their acts and avoid becoming bitter. His voice rose with the conviction of his chapel speeches. Son, if you don't become bitter, nothing can stop you from success. Remember that.
I shall, sir, I said. Then my throat thickened, and I hoped he would bring up the matter of a job himself.
Instead, he looked at me impatiently and said, Well, I have work to do. My permission is granted.
Well, sir, I'd like to ask a favor of you.
Favor, he said shrewdly. Now, that's another matter. What kind of favor?
It isn't much, sir. You suggested that you would put me in touch with some of the trustees who would give me a job. I'm willing to do anything.
Oh, yes, he said, yes. Of course.
He seemed to think for a moment, his eyes studying the objects on his desk. Then, touching the shackle gently with his index finger, he said,
Very well. When do you intend to leave?
By the first bus, if possible, sir.
Are you packed?
Yes, sir.
Very well. Go get your bags and return here in 30 minutes. My secretary will give you some letters addressed to several friends of the school. One of them will do something for you.
Thanks, sir. Thank you very much, I said as he stood.
That's all right, he said. The school tries to look out for its own. Only one thing more. These letters will be sealed. Don't open them if you want help. White folk are strict about such things. The letters will introduce you and request them to help you with a job. I'll do my best for you, and it isn't necessary for you to open them, understand?
Oh, I wouldn't think of opening them, sir, I said.
Very well. The young lady will have them for you when you return. What about your parents? Have you informed them?
No, sir. It might make them feel too bad if I told them I was expelled, so I plan to write them after I get there and get a job.
I see. Perhaps that is best.
Well, goodbye, sir, I said, extending my hand.
Goodbye, he said.
His hand was large and strangely limp. He pressed a buzzer as I turned to leave. His secretary brushed past me as I went through the door. The letters were waiting when I returned, 7 of them, addressed to men with impressive names. I looked for Mr. Norton's, but his was not among them. Placing them carefully in my inside pocket, I grabbed my bags and hurried for the bus. The station was empty, but the ticket window was open and a porter in a gray uniform was pushing a broom. I bought my ticket and climbed into the bus. There were only 2 passengers seated at the rear of the red and nickel interior, and I suddenly felt that I was dreaming. It was the vet. He gave me a smile of recognition. An attendant sat beside him.
Welcome, young man, he called. Imagine Mr. Crenshaw, he said to the attendant. We have a traveling companion.
Morning, I said reluctantly. I looked around for a seat away from them, but although the bus was almost empty, only the rear was reserved for us, and there was nothing to do but move back with them. I didn't like it. The vet was too much a part of an experience which I was already trying to blot out of my consciousness. His way of talking to Mr. Norton had been a foreshadowing of my misfortune, just as I had sensed that it would be. Now, having accepted my punishment, I wanted to remember nothing connected with True Blood or the Golden Day. Crenshaw, a much smaller man than Supercargo, said nothing. He was not the type usually sent out to accompany violent cases. And I was glad until I remembered that the only violent thing about the vet was his tongue. His mouth had already gotten me into trouble, and now I hoped he wouldn't turn it upon the white driver. That was apt to get us killed. What was he doing on the bus anyway? God, how had Dr. Bledsoe worked that fast? I stared at the fat man.
How did your friend Mr. Norton make out? He asked.
He's okay, I said.
No more fainting spells?
No.
Did he bawl you out for what happened?
He didn't blame me, I said.
Good. I think I shocked him more than anything else he saw at the Golden Day. I hoped I hadn't caused you trouble.
School isn't out so soon, is it?
Not quite, I said lightly. I'm leaving early in order to take a job.
Wonderful! At home?
No, I thought I might make more money in New York.
New York, he said. That's not a place, it's a dream. When I was your age, it was Chicago. Now all the little black boys run away to New York, out of the fire and into the melting pot. I can see you after you've lived in Harlem for 3 months. Your speech will change. You'll talk a lot about college. You'll attend lectures at the men's house. You might even meet a few white folks. And listen, he said, leaning close to whisper, you might even dance with a white girl. I'm going to New York to work, I said, looking around me. I won't have time for that.
You will, though, he teased. Deep down, you're thinking about the freedom you've heard about up north, and you'll try it once, just to see if what you've heard is true.
There's other kinds of freedom besides some old white trash woman, Crenshaw said. He might want to see him some shows and eating some of them big restaurants.
The vet grinned.
Why, of course, but remember, Crenshaw, he's only going to be there a few months. Most of the time, he'll be working, and so much of his freedom will have to be symbolic. And what will be his or any man's most easily accessible symbol of freedom? Why, a woman, of course. In 20 minutes, he can inflate that symbol with all the freedom which he'll be too busy working to enjoy the rest of the time. He'll see...
I tried to change the subject. Where are you going? I asked.
To Washington, D.C., he said.
Then you're cured.
Cured! There is no cure. He's being transferred, said Crenshaw.
Yes, I'm headed for St. Elizabeth's, the vet said.
The ways of authority are indeed mysterious. For a year I've tried to get transferred, then this morning I'm suddenly told to pack. I can't but wonder if our little conversation with your friend, Mr. Norton, had something to do with it.
How could he have anything to do with it, I said, remembering Dr. Bledsoe's threat.
How could he have anything to do with your being on this bus, he said.
He winked, his eyes twinkled.
All right, forget what I've said. But for God's sake, learn to look beneath the surface, he said. Come out of the fog, young man. And remember, you don't have to be a complete fool in order to succeed. Play the game, but don't believe in it. That much you owe yourself. Even if it lands you in a straitjacket or a padded cell, play the game, but play it your own way. Part of the time, at least. Play the game, but raise the ante, my boy. Learn how it operates. Learn how you operate. I wish I had time to tell you only a fragment. We're an ass-backward people, though. You might even beat the game. It's really a very crude affair. Really pre-Renaissance. And that game has been analyzed, put down in books. But down here, they've forgotten to take care of the books. And that's your opportunity. You're hidden right out in the open. That is, you would be if you only realized it. They wouldn't see you because they don't expect you to know anything, since they believe they've taken care of that. Man, who's this they you talking so much about, said Crenshaw.
The vet looked annoyed.
They, he said. They? Why, the same they we always mean. The white folks, authority, the gods, fate, circumstances. The force that pulls your strings until you refuse to be pulled anymore. The big man who's never there where you think he is.
Crenshaw grimaced.
You talk too damn much, man. He said, you talk and you don't say nothing.
Oh, I have a lot to say, Crenshaw. I put into words things which most men feel, if only slightly. Sure, I'm a compulsive talker of a kind, but I'm really more clown than fool. But Crenshaw, he said, rolling a wand of the newspaper which lay across his knees,
you don't realize what's happening. Our young friend is going north for the first time. It is for the first time, isn't it?
You're right, I said.
Of course. Were you ever north before, Crenshaw? I've been all over the country, Crenshaw said.
I know how they do wherever they do it. And I know how to act, too. Besides, you ain't going north, not the real north. You going to Washington. It's just another southern town.
Yes, I know, the vet said. But think of what this means for the young fellow. He's going free, in the broad daylight, and alone. I can remember when young fellows like him had first to commit a crime or be accused of one before they tried such a thing. Instead of leaving in the light of morning, they went in the dark of night. And no bus was fast enough. Isn't that so, Crenshaw?
Crenshaw stopped unwrapping a candy bar and looked at him sharply, his eyes narrowed.
How the hell I know, he said. I'm sorry, Crenshaw, the vet said. I thought that as a man of experience. Well, I ain't had that experience. I went north of my own free will.
But haven't you heard of such cases?
He ain't experiencing, Crenshaw said.
No, it isn't, but since there's always an element of crime and freedom,
I ain't committed no crime.
I didn't mean that you had, the vet said. I apologize. Forget it.
Crenshaw took an angry bite from his candy bar, mumbling,
I wish you'd hurry up and get depressive. Maybe then you won't talk so damn much.
Yes, doctor, the vet said mockingly. I'll be depressive soon enough, but while you eat your candy, just allow me to chew the rag. There's a kind of substance in it.
Oh, quit trying to show off your education, Crenshaw said. You riding back here in the Jim Crow just like me. Besides, you a nut.
The vet winked at me, continuing his flow of words as the bus got underway. We were going at last, and I took a last longing look as the bus shot around the highway which circled the school. I turned and watched it recede from the rear window. The sun caught its treetops, bathed its low-set buildings and ordered grounds. Then it was gone. In less than 5 minutes, the spot of earth which I identified with the best of all possible worlds was gone. Lost within the wild, uncultivated countryside. A flash of movement drew my eye to the side of the highway now when I saw a moccasin wiggle swiftly along the gray concrete, vanishing into a length of iron pipe that lay beside the road. I watched the flashing past of cotton fields and cabins, feeling that I was moving into the unknown. The vet and Crenshaw prepared to change buses at the next stop, and upon leaving, the vet placed his hand upon my shoulder and looked at me with kindness, and, as always, he smiled.
Now is the time for offering fatherly advice, he said, but I'll have to spare you that since I guess I'm nobody's father except my own. Well, perhaps that's the advice to give you. Be your own father, young man, and remember the world is possibility, if only you'll discover it. Last of all, leave the Mr. Nortons alone, and if you don't know what I mean, think about it. Farewell.
I watched him following Crenshaw through the group of passengers waiting to get on, a short, comical figure turning to wave, then disappearing through the door of the red brick terminal. I sat back with a sigh of relief, yet once the passengers were aboard and the bus was underway again, I felt sad and utterly alone. Not until we were sailing through the Jersey countryside did my spirits begin to rise. Then my old confidence and optimism revived, and I tried to plan my time in the north. I would work hard and serve my employer so well that he would shower Dr. Bledsoe with favorable reports. I would save my money and return in the fall full of New York culture. I'd be indisputably the leading campus figure. Perhaps I would attend town meeting, which I had heard over the radio. I'd learn the platform tricks of the leading speakers, and I would make the best of my contacts. When I met the big men to whom my letters were addressed, I would put on my best manner. I would speak softly in my most polished tones, smile agreeably, and be most polite. and I would remember that if he meant any of the important gentlemen, should begin a topic of conversation, I would never begin a subject of my own, which I found unfamiliar. I would smile and agree. My shoes would be polished, my suit pressed, my hair dressed not too much grease, and parted on the right side. My nails would be clean and my armpits well deodorized. You had to watch the last item. You couldn't allow them to think all of us smelled bad. The very thought of my contacts gave me a feeling of sophistication, of worldliness, which, as I fingered the 7 important letters in my pocket, made me feel light and expansive. I dreamed with my eyes gazing blankly upon the landscape until I looked up to see a red cap frowning down. Buddy, you getting off here? He said. If so, you better get started. Oh, sure, I said, beginning to move. Sure, but, how do you get to Harlem? Well, that's easy, he said. You just keep heading north. And while I got down my bags and my prized briefcase, still as shiny as the night of the Battle Royal, he instructed me how to take the subway. Then I struggled through the crowd. Moving into the subway, I was pushed along by the milling salt and pepper mob, seized in the back by a burly, blue-uniformed attendant about the size of supercargo, and crammed, bags and all, into a train that was so crowded that everyone seemed to stand with his head back and his eyes bulging like chickens frozen at the sound of danger. Then the door banged behind me, and I was crushed against a huge woman in black who shook her head and smiled while I stared with horror at a large mole that arose out of the oily whiteness of her skin like a black mountain sweeping out of a rain-wet plain. And all the while, I could feel the rubbery softness of her flesh against the length of my body. I could neither turn sideways, nor back away, nor set down my bags. I was trapped. So close that simply by nodding my head, I might have brushed her lips with mine. I wanted desperately to raise my hands to show her that it was against my will. I kept expecting her to scream until finally the car lurched and I was able to free my left arm. I closed my eyes, holding desperately to my lapel. The car roared and swayed, pressing me hard against her. But when I took a furtive glance around, no one was paying me the slightest attention. And even she seemed lost in her own thoughts. The train seemed to plunge downhill now, only to lunge to a stop that shot me out upon a platform, feeling like something regurgitated from the belly of a frantic whale. Wrestling with my bags, I swept along with the crowd, up the stairs, into the hot street. I didn't care where I was, I would walk the rest of the way. For a moment, I stood before a shop window staring at my own reflection in the glass, trying to recover from the ride against the woman. I was limp, my clothing wet. But you're up north now, I told myself. Up north. Yes, but suppose she had screamed. The next time I used the subway, I'd always be sure to enter with my hands grasping my lapels, and I'd keep them there until I left the train. Why, my God, they must have riots on those things all the time. Why hadn't I read about them? I had never seen so many black people against a background of brick buildings, neon signs, plate glass, and roaring traffic, not even on trips I had made with the debating team to New Orleans, Dallas, or Birmingham. They were everywhere, so many, and moving along with so much tension and noise that I wasn't sure whether they were about to celebrate a holiday or join in a street fight. There were even black girls behind the counters of the 5 and 10 as I passed. Then, at the street intersection, I had the shock of seeing a black policeman directing traffic, and there were white drivers in the traffic who obeyed his signals as though it was the most natural thing in the world. Sure, I had heard of it, but this was real. My courage returned. This really was Harlem. And now all the stories which I had heard of the city within a city leaped alive in my mind. The vet had been right. For me, this was not a city of realities, but of
dreams, perhaps because I had always thought of my life as being confined to the South. And now, as I struggled through the lines of people, a new world of possibility suggested itself to me, faintly, like a small voice that was barely audible in the roar of city sounds. I moved, wide-eyed, trying to take the bombardment of impressions. Then I stopped still. It was ahead of me, angry and shrill, and upon hearing it, I had a sensation of shock and fear such as I had felt as a child when surprised by my father's voice. An emptiness widened in my stomach. Before me, a gathering of people were almost blocking the walk, while above them, a short, squat man shouted angrily from a ladder to which were attached a collection of small American flags.
"We're gone, chase him out," the man cried. "Out! Tell him about it, Rossman," a voice called.
And I saw the squat man shake his fist angrily over the uplifted faces, yelling something in a staccato West Indian accent at which the crowd yelled threateningly. It was as though a riot would break any minute, against whom, I didn't know. I was puzzled both by the effect of his voice upon me and by the obvious anger of the crowd. I had never seen so many black men angry in public before, and yet others passed the gathering by without a glance. And, as I came alongside, I saw two white policemen talking quietly with one another, their backs turned as they laughed at some joke. Even when the shirt-sleeved crowd cried out in angry affirmation of some remark of the speaker, they paid no attention. I was stunned. I stood gaping at the policemen, my bag settling upon the middle of the walk until one of them happened to see me and nudged the other, who chewed lazily upon a wad of gum.
"What can we do for you, bud?" he said.
I was just wondering, I said, before I caught myself.
"Yeah?"
I was just wondering how to get to Men's House, sir, I said.
"Is that all?"
Yes, sir, I stammered.
"You're sure?"
"Yes, sir."
"He's a stranger," the other said. "Just coming to town, bud?"
Yes, sir, I said. I just got off the subway.
"You did, huh? Well, you want to be careful."
"Oh, I will, sir."
"That's the idea. Keep it clean," he said, and directed me to Men's House.
I thanked them and hurried on. The speaker had become more violent than before, and his remarks were about the government. The clash between the calm of the rest of the street and the passion of the voice gave the scene a strange, out-of-joint quality, and I was careful not to look back, lest I see a riot flare. I reached Men's House in a sweat, registered, and went immediately to my room. I would have to take Harlem a little at a time.
Context of white supremacy. So we will pick up. Second audio segment will be at the very beginning of chapter 8. Until then, folks have commentary they would like to share. The number to dial 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you want to join the discussion but you don't want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line, which is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.ty.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. Address again, tiny.ty.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. When you put in that address, look on the left side of the page. You'll see the link for the free VOPE line. Click that link. It will open a new window on your screen. Once you get that window open, the top line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for a code. That code again, 564 9-4-3. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in real name, nickname. You can press random keys. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live broadcast. Same procedure. If you would like to participate, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 61. That will raise your hand on my switchboard. I will open your line and you can share your thoughts. That said, again, Joe Morton, fantastic job as the narrator. I have heard, I think I'm probably one of the few folks I have heard more of Joe Morton narrating Invisible Man than what he contributed to Scandal. If you have commentary, questions you would like to share on the first portion of the audio commentary that we got from today. If you have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus, and everybody else. Yeah, this is my first time actually commenting because I actually had to catch up. So I was catching up by listening to the past readings. I would just say on this session, that was probably the most helpful suspension that I've ever heard, especially at a historical black college. I attended two of them and came close to being in that position myself. But I've kind of like heard the type of logic that the president was sharing with this student. I've kind of like heard it before, you know. That's some of the jargon that we do when white people are not around. We mention about how much we outsmarted them, how much we outsmarted them, based on, you know, not really telling them the truth about things, basically telling them what they want to hear. It is true. White people do like to be complimented and told outright that, you know, you're the best, you're the prettiest, you know, that sort of thing like that. I understand it from that standpoint. At the historical black colleges, at that particular period of time, is that what, in the 20s or the 30s?
The book was written in 1952, but the period that he's describing in the book is in the 1920s.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, during that time, they were still basically new at the time, and you had, when a white person does visit and whatnot, you have to the non-white victims of racial white supremacy felt that they had to, and they probably were right, they had to talk sweet to the white people in their face, and in his position, meaning the central person, in his position, he definitely had to be very careful. Apparently, he wasn't, as he should have, to the administration. And so, but then again, during that time, you know, who else they were going to choose to do it? Because I would imagine the population during that particular point in time was not as large as the populations of some of the schools are now, of course. It was something I was going to say about the last part, the very last part. Oh, yeah, in Harlem. He that I guess that was his first time going to Harlem. That's a question.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I've heard that a lot. You know, when a person visited a Harlem or something similar to a Harlem for the first time, especially during that time, and even during a time when the writer was writing the book, that they were, you know, basically impressed by some things that they normally wouldn't see in certain parts of this part of the world, you know. But nevertheless, if it was some sort of utopia, it wouldn't have needed a Malcolm X who saw it on both sides, you know, as far as that concerned. If I'm understood on what I'm talking about, it wouldn't need a Malcolm X on either side, whether it was Detroit Red or Malik Shabazz. He wouldn't have been needed. So that's all I have to say right now, and I'll continue listening. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Other folks who doubt? Oh, Mr. Demery? Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. May I be heard? Okay. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to the other callers and listeners. The first thing that I'd like to say is that it was an excellent opening. And the fan is blowing my paper away. Here we go. Big ups, you know, to the host, Gus, for the intro, especially the song Black and Blue. I think that was Louis Armstrong. What did I do to be so black and blue? The last thing said was that maybe someone in our generation can pick up where Ralph Ellison left off, but with the ghostwriters of today and white people putting their hands in on the editing of all these types of works, it's very unlikely that we'll see this type of brilliant literary work. But I wanted to start, you know, it was so amazing when Reverend Homer Barbee was talking, and you challenged us last week and said if it was something significant about the Reverend being blind. And so turns out it is. It's very important. Dr. Bledsoe, although Dr. Barbee was blind physically, Dr. Bledsoe was blind spiritually. Dr. Bledsoe had his priorities in the wrong place. He was basically concerned with the distinguished white guest, whereas Dr. Barbee couldn't see the audience, so he didn't know whether they were white or black. So his sermon, assuming everyone was black, you know, was centered at the young black audience. And then his sermon, the way he was speaking like the old preachers, you know, getting high with their voices and, you know, almost singing and everything, the young educated blacks that were so-called progressive could not identify with that and thought it was uncivilized and undignified. But it was the old lady in the back that responded, you know, like, hey, man, or whatever, jumps up, shout. And then she realizes she's out of place among these so-called progressive individuals, and she becomes quiet. I thought that was interesting, the way that he incorporates, you know, all these type of scenarios. And I got ahead of myself last week, but this is the time when the narrator said that for 3 years I had thought of myself as a man, and here in a few words he had made me as helpless as an infant. Dr. Bledsoe, through his scolding and talking down to the protagonist, had made him feel less than a man. And he had taken away his feeling of manhood. And in essence, at this time, I think that that probably was a moment of rebirth for him. Dr. Bledsoe, I guess everybody can see by what he was saying, astonishing thing he said, that he will have, I believe, I may be misquoting, but I will have every nigger hang before I give up my position. So at that time, it's very significant because at that time there were lynchings all over America, and then there, it was a big concern. And it's one of the major things that activists at that time was trying to prevent. And then for him to say that right there just held so much intensity. And then he gave a double standard to the young student by saying that he wasn't a white man, don't lie to him. And although he was a so-called, he was, you know, what you would call, I don't know how to say it without actually name calling, but he wasn't as he had seemed to be or what he thought he really was. I think he had reality and fantasy mixed up, thinking he was in power and that he had some sense of power. And then one last thing, the bus scene when he was leaving the college, I think that the vet that he ran into may have been Sebastian because of the way he was talking. And then Dr. Bledsoe had promised to, when he learned of the vet, he promised to get rid of him. So it would play right into if he had somehow gotten Sylvester transferred to Washington, D.C. And I thought it was funny that Sylvester would say he'd been working for a transfer to St. Elizabeth, and no one, you know, wants to transfer to some insane asylum. But anyway, and then there's only two people on the bus, and they sitting all the way in the back, which shows the absurdity of those Jim Crow bus riding laws. No one else on the bus, but the black people have to still go to the back. And then the last parting thing that the vet told him was that you can play the game, but play it your own way, part of the time at least. Play the game, but raise the ante. My boy, learn how it operates. Learn how you operate. I wish I had time to tell you only a fragment. I think he was probably talking about the system of white supremacy. He didn't really have time to explain all this to him, but the most important advice he gave, stay away from them, Dr. Norton. And what he was saying basically is know yourself, and that message was different from the message he had gotten from his grandfather. And another thing of importance, the vet said that he was really more of a clown than a fool, and that's what the system of white supremacy produces with black non-white people, clowns and fools. Also a reference to a white woman. I'll mute my line, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Indeed, it is getting close to summertime. Break out the fans. Hope your wife is doing well, recuperating. Just quickly, just for make sure folks are clear, Sylvester is one of the vets at the Golden Day, but he is not the vet who got kicked out and was on the bus with our narrator. Important because that particular vet who was on the bus is also unnamed. Very important that he also doesn't get a name like our main character. But Sylvester is one of the vets. Other folks, if you dialed in, if you have commentary you would like to share, Red in Nevada. Line should be open if you have commentary.
Hello. Thank you, Gus. Thank you for taking my call. Hello, everyone. I'm trying to make sure because I didn't hear the segment, but I'd already caught up. I thought with the first part, I think that was back in chapter 6, when the main character was speaking to Dr. Bledsoe, the main thing that stuck out to me, and I don't know if someone already mentioned this or not, was the part where it said, it was as the, when Dr. Bledsoe, he said, "Nigger, this isn't the time to lie. I'm the white man." And then when the Invisible Man said, it was as though he had struck me. I stared across the desk thinking he called me that. And I'm just seeing, and sometimes when I'm like reading, I keep going back to the question that Gus had asked, you know, well, why do white people like this book so much? And I don't know if the author was really masterful with his subtle white worship and then anti-blackness, and also with the fierce individualism of like the of the main character and of the Dr. Bledsoes, basically, you know, well, they've transcended the, as Dr. Bledsoe had mentioned, I guess it was it like the field hands, the field Negroes, what have you. Oh yeah, the dumbest black bastard in the cotton patch. I guess they kind of separated themselves from that when there's really no separation. You know, you are the ghetto, and that's something that I really try to remember. So that was the main call out from that part. And then in the chapter 7, I also thought like Mr. Demery Ford, it was the mentioning of the white woman, of course, how they had to sit in the back of the bus, even though it was empty. When the Invisible Man said, "I remember that the only violent thing about the vet was his tongue." And it's just kind of like where we're supposed to, white supremacy has this awful way of making sure that we self-correct. So if someone does try to make someone more enlightened about the trueness of the system, we're supposed to automatically feel like they're violent, that they're the worst thing ever. So I thought that that sentence was important, violent just because he was speaking. The other thing, you know, Crenshaw was talking about, you know, there's other freedoms besides white trash women, of course, the cowbell there. Also, one second. Also, I like the part where I can't remember who said it, but he said, someone said it, "We're an ass backward people though." And I felt like that might've been the way, maybe that was a way that the author was kind of, you know, subliminally shaking in things that, you know, maybe we do need to reassess how we're trying to approach this problem, just how maybe like the whole, quote from grandfather. And also it made me think about the other book, the part about where Crenshaw and the vet was talking, and I'm just talking about, well, why was the Invisible Man going up north so fast, and how it says, well, we ain't had that experience. I went up north of all of my own free will. And they were basically just talking about, you know, usually you don't go up north and for no reason. And Crenshaw was like, I never did anything to a white woman to have me, you know, going up north in the middle of the night. He can go up north during the day. And so it made me think about the warmth of other suns. And the other part, I think Mr. Demery Ford had mentioned something about the leave the Mr. Norton's alone. I did also highlight that. And I don't know if we got to this part or not, when he was in Harlem and he was at the train station, and I think he was on the bus, and the part that I noted was all the while I could feel the rubbery softness of her flesh against the length of my body. I could neither turn sideways nor back away, nor set down my bags. And it still seems like, even though this white woman, he's referencing a white woman in that passage, even though this white woman is supposed to be at least grotesque, like there's the mole that he's describing as the black mole and whiteness or whatever, it still has this, it's rubbery, but it's soft. she has this rubbery softness of it. So I think that's just another way of just kind of subliminally playing into, even though there's people are grotesque, they still should be somewhat worshipped. And I'll mute my line. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Appreciate that. Red in Nevada. If other folks have comments, I have notes and such, but I generally try to let people go first so I don't steal anyone's shine, as they say. If you have commentary that you want to share, I do think it's important also that, at least to keep in mind as we proceed, this book was published 3 years before Emmett Till was lynched and castrated, 1955. This book was published in 1952. Just something to think about in terms of the reference, the value of Black life, things that were happening and had not even happened. Speaking of the buses, the Montgomery bus boycott had not even happened when this book was published. Anyway, I'll keep an eye on the switchboard. Some of the things that, notes rather, that I took from this chapter. And I guess with all of that in mind, something that I think people should keep in mind, rate, and particularly Black anger. I think we ended just as the main character was arriving in Harlem, and he was so surprised at seeing not just a large group of angry Black people in public. Not just a large group of Black people, but angry Black people in public. And that this was not causing like a problem. Now, again, this book, where we are right now, is set in the 1920s, book published in the 1950s, but just again showing the type of surveillance and the way that the plantation was operated at that time. I think that's important. And a lot of what we've heard at this point in the book, there are folks who say that they describe Langston or Ralph Ellison's writing as hateful, and say that Ralph Ellison was a very angry person. And I agree with that. I agree with that completely. And in fact, I would just say, look at the number of different ways, something to keep an eye on as we read, look at the number of different ways that Black people engaging in counter violence comes up, is depicted in this book. I mentioned before you had the conversation at the Golden Day that seemed like kind of just the throwaway conversation. Jack Johnson, Jim Jeffries. Jack Johnson just got pardoned this week. President Trump, I think it was yesterday, he just pardoned posthumously Jack Johnson, but first Black heavyweight champion. That fight was huge. Again, I think I said this before, that was like Mayweather-McGregor at the turn of the 20th century. You had riots. They talked about race riots. There were literally race riots, as they called them. White people going and shooting and killing and abusing Black people all across the country as a result of that fight that Ralph Ellison mentions. The vet last week, the week before, when Mr. Norton goes to the Golden Day, the vet threatens to bash both of their skulls in. The book opens up. We have his dream sequence when he gets the reefer and he's on the plantation where the enslaved Black female has already said she's poisoned the master. And she did this because her children, they were going to kill him. Lots of different instances. And even before that, where you have the mugging, where he grabs the white guy, he headbutts him and he regrets not killing him. For a book written in the 1952, I would even say a book written in 2018, we're only 7 chapters in. That's a lot of examples of Black people committing counter violence against the white people. Way more than we got in The Hate U Give, I think. If anyone disagrees and can remember where Chris or any of the other whites that were being worshipped in that book were beaten up or any other forms of counter violence against white people, let me know. But I mean, it's a lot. Just something to keep in mind and think about. Langston Hughes as an angry Black writer and angry with white people specifically. Anyway, notes that I took. I think the contempt of Dr. Bledsoe and really the entire college. I think we might have missed the line from last week. I think one of the most important lines in the book, even if we didn't miss it, it's worth being said, you know, 50 as many times as possible. He says, "Then in my mind's eye, I see the bronze statue of the college founder, the cold father symbol, founder and father, both with capital F's significant, his hands outstretched in the breathtaking gesture of lifting a veil that flutters in hard metallic folds above the face of a kneeling slave, and I am standing puzzled, unable to decide whether the veil is really being lifted or lowered more firmly in place, whether I am witnessing a revelation or a more efficient blinding. Particularly important since this is the college statue, Reverend Barbie is blind as well. I mean, wow. But I think especially important, this institution, the contempt for black people at a place where you think this is a historically black college. They, you know, got to be tons of black self-respect here. That's not what this is about at all. This is about white worship and cranking out zombies who will continue to support the system of racism, white supremacy, and who will seek white validation, will be super white identified, and will want to do the biddings of the Mr. and Mrs. Nortons all over the known universe. And particularly that anti-blackness. You hear it consistently from our narrator, even before he got to college, and you continue to hear it the way that he talks about other black people. You hear it from Dr. Bledsoe, the way that he talks about other black people, and even the school-wide contempt that the narrator said that they have for black people like True Blood, black people like Reverend Barbie. If anyone, any other black person had come around singing in that way and behaving in that way, they would have looked down on them. They're like, oh, you know, detestable niggers. It's their fault that we haven't been able to advance. I think the self-correcting, very important. I think that was Red that brought that point up. Lots of that Dr. Bledsoe, where he hears about the vet, like, what? He talked like a white man. I'll have to investigate him. Negro like that should be under lock and key. There's lots of that that goes on, and that's years of terrorizing, conditioning against black people. Let's see. Very important. This is just one to keep in mind for as we continue with the text. The leg shackle from slavery, which Dr. Bledsoe proudly called a symbol of our progress. Just something to file that away and keep that in mind as we continue to read. Dr. Bledsoe, like many non-white people, myself included, he's a victim of racism. He's confused about racism. He also, I think, is occasionally saying one or two things that are accurate, which I think makes his commentary even more compelling. In this, when he's kind of talking down to the main character here, where he tells him, Negroes don't control this school or much of anything else. Haven't you learned even that? Important one that I think even in 2018, some people do not understand, which if Negroes don't control anything, that would also mean that you can't have a leader. Leaders got to be able to control things. When he continues, Dr. Bledsoe, and he says right after that, he says, as big and black, and I say, yes, sir, as loudly as any burrhead when it's convenient, but I'm still the king down here. That right there, that contempt, that anti-blackness, but that almost reminds me of grandfather's words at the beginning of the book where you yes him to death. Yes, sir, master. Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. And bussum lot, that almost kind of sounds like granddad again, whose name was invoked repeatedly this week in the text. That came to mind. Also, I think a lot of non-white people, unfortunately, we get very confused in thinking that whites, if they have given us a position or allow us to do certain things, I think sometimes we get very confused, particularly if we are allowed to boss around a lot of other non-white people, we can be very, very confused and forget that, oh, whites are allowing me to do this, to be the HNIC, as they say sometimes. And even within that, his fantasy, I think, as Mr. Demerfor was saying, he does occasionally dip back into reality. He says, when you buck against me, you're bucking against power, rich white folks' power. That right there, in my view, it's not really you that has this power. The rich white people can get rid of you when they feel like it. Let's see. Oh, yeah, I thought the Mr. Demi Ford's line where he said, when Dr. Bledsoe said, I've made my place in it and I'll have every Negro in the country hanging on tree limbs by morning if it means staying where I am, I can then only repeat this book was published 3 years before Emmett Till was lynched. Continuing, he says, when he says, I had to act the nigger. He continues, super fascinating. I don't insist that it was worth it, but now I'm here and I mean to stay. After you win the game, put that in quotes, win, you take the prize and you keep it, protect it, and there's nothing else to do. He shrugged. A man gets old winning his place, son. So you go ahead, you tell your story, match your truth against my truth, because what I've said is truth, the broader truth. I thought this was really important where he's even kind of admitting at some level, maybe this wasn't worth it. Maybe I did all that acting a nigger. Yes, sir. Being the loudest burr head, as he said, on the plantation. Maybe all that wasn't even worth it. All I've got to show for is being the HNIC on this little rickety campus and chauffeuring whites around or getting my students to chauffeur whites around. And I got my two Cadillacs and my leg shackle here. Maybe it wasn't really worth it, but I did all that. I invested all this into it. So I'm going to hold on to what I got. And if that means I got to hang every one of you niggers, then so be it. I think racists, they condition a lot of victims of white supremacy to function in exactly that manner. They have allowed us a slightly larger piece of cornbread, and we will fight, kill, stomp, do everything that we possibly can to preserve that slightly larger nugget of cornbread. Next. Yeah, I thought that was a super important this line as well. Mr. Demi Ford said about him thinking that he was a man reminded me so much of Mr. Fuller. The portion with the narrator where he says, you have some white folk backing you and you don't want to face them because nothing is worse for a black man than to be humiliated by white folk. I know all about that too. Old Doc's been buked and scorned and all that. I know about it, but you'll get over it. It's foolish and expensive and a lot of dead weight. You let white folk worry about pride and dignity. Man, I was thinking of Mr. Fuller. Difference between a dignified slave and a silly one. You learn where you are and you get yourself power, influence, contacts with powerful, influential people, white people. Then stay in the dark and use it. I just, that whole portion, pride and dignity. Again, like I said, I think he is saying some very significant, truthful things, almost some things that remind me of the veteran or someone speaking honestly about racism, but there's a lot of confusion added in as well. Generally the case with speaking to a victim of white supremacy. His man, the descriptive language that he invokes after all of this has happened, and he's kind of letting it sink in that he's going to be ejected from the campus, and he's thinking, oh, what a disgrace, I've let my parents down and my white friends are going to reject me. White friends, and at this time in the 1920s, that's laughable, white friends, but my white friends are going to let me down. He says, how had I come to this? How had I kept unswervingly to the path placed before? I had kept unswervingly to the path placed before me, had tried to be exactly what I was expected to be, had done exactly what I was expected to do, yet instead of winning the expected reward, here I was stumbling along, holding on desperately to one of my eyes in order to keep from bursting out my brain against some familiar object swerved into my path by my distorted vision. Wow. Langston Hughes. Masterpiece writing. And just in a text called Invisible Man, I think that's so important. I think we talked about that before. Seeing is understanding at this point. He clearly does not understand racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works, and it is totally distorting his vision about everything else. And as has the entire college experience, sermons from blind victims of racism, and then they got statues where they're blinding you even more. I mean, just wow, what powerful imagery to describe his state of confusion, and then grandfather gets invoked again. I had some other things that I took note of, but I think the last thing that I will get in, and then I'll check to see if any of the listeners have commentary that they want to share. The portion from chapter 7. He's been ejected. He's already bumped into the vet on the bus, and they talk about white women. And that could be the freedom in New York, which interestingly becomes the first thing that happens to him. He gets to Harlem, he gets on the subway, and is mashed against this tubby white woman. But the portion where he's talking, and he says, when talking about getting to New York and hanging out with these white contacts that he thinks he's going to make, he says, "I would speak softly in my most polished tones, smile agreeably, and be most polite. And I would remember that if he meant any of the important gentlemen, white, should begin a topic of conversation, I would never begin a subject on my own, which I found unfamiliar. I would smile and agree." Very automaton-like, zombie-like. "My shoes would be polished, my suit pressed, my hair dressed, not too much grease, and parted on the right side. My nails would be clean, and my armpits well deodorized. You had to watch the last item. You couldn't allow them to think all of us smelled bad." I mean, the meticulous detail. It almost kind of reminds me of Star a little bit. I don't think she has anything as meticulous. Anyone who was with us for The Hate U Give, almost reminding me of Star a little bit. But I've heard that so many times. I think so many of us can relate to that in a variety of ways, as though in some way, if you do all of these things, I will not be thought of as a nigger. I will not be a victim of white supremacy, which is simply not the case. I will stop there. I do have other notes, but just in case other people have commentary that they want to get in. Any of the other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary you would like to share, *61, or if we have lots of spectators, not sure if we just have people. Don't know how you could listen to Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man and not have questions or comments, but we have lots of spectators, apparently. Did other folks have comments, questions? Everyone satisfied?
Excuse me. Gus, if no one wants to go right now, I wanted to mention that he mentioned something when they were on the bus and the vet was talking, and he was saying that he hoped that the vet didn't get out of line too much because, you know, it may piss the bus driver off. And I thought that was interesting because there was a time when those bus drivers wore guns, and if they felt that a black person, you know, had violated some law or whatever, they could actually notify the police, but then they had the authority to actually just shoot a black person, you know, throw them off the bus. and so he brought that up, you know, on the bus, hoping that the vet didn't, you know, I guess rub the bus driver the wrong way where he could, you know, possibly end up, you know, taking somebody's life. And I think there's one other, let's see, yeah. Okay, it was something I had right in the, okay, bus driver, right? Okay. Yeah, I think that's about it. That's, you talked about the smell, you know, and I thought that, you know, for him to be naive and a young man coming to New York for the first time, he knew quite a bit about what white folk, a lot about what white people liked and didn't like, especially about black people. Like you said, make sure his armpits were clean because, you know, he didn't want white people to think that all black people smell. And I could see why some blacks at that particular time when the book was coming out would, you know, think that maybe Ralph Ellison was actually talking about him rather than just, you know, some literary work. Okay, I'll mute my line. Thanks, Gus.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery Ford. Emmy, if you had commentary, line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everyone. Unfortunately, I am still trying to get home, get myself situated and whatnot. But I think a lot of people have already commented and pulled out some of the pieces that I thought were most impactful and very interesting. However, the one like overarching theme that I keep witnessing in the text, but also in my own life, that sometimes that crazy black person, that poor black person, that run-down black person is way smarter than I am. And I began realizing that sometime when I was in D.C., and there are a lot of people who don't have homes, a lot of people who don't have money, and that kind of thing, and they appear crazy or don't talk properly or whatever it is. But if you listen closely enough, to use a metaphor, they be dropping gems. And I feel this way about that, and I think that that is a theme that I am seeing in the text. I don't know how many other characters the narrator is going to run into who will fit into this theme, but that seems to me to be something to pay attention to. The other thing is that is a little, that's just interesting, I guess. I don't know what other better word to use for it, is that non-white people, who black people specifically, who haven't spent a lot of time around white people, for whatever reason, don't understand those subtle nonverbals or those subtle ways. When Dr. Bledsoe was talking about, he may not know that he wants you punished, but I know that he wants you punished, that type of thing. Or in the last section that we read, when the white man, I forget his name now, I think Norman or something like that, was like either raising his eyebrows or dropping his tone and stuff like that. Like, you have to be around white people to pick up on these things and to know that, like, to be able to really know their subtle, slick ways of conveying their likes and dislikes and their expectations and your behavior. And I know that personally because I have spent a lot of time around white people, but also in my work environment. They do things with, like, inflections in their voice or flickers in their eyes and things like that, that if you don't catch, then it will be your downfall. And I've been seeing that a lot in the text, too, because he wouldn't come out and just say something direct, but it was very subversive, his influence. And so I kind of really are, I could foresee that Dr. Bledsoe was definitely going to expel him just off of that, even excusing him from the room. Like, white people do those kinds of things all the time, even at work. Even in school, they do those things. So anyway, those are my commentary for now until I get situated. I thank you all for listening.
Much obliged, Emmy. Rob in Wisconsin, did you have commentary, sir? Or might not even be Rob. Is this Rob in Wisconsin? Got my numbers incorrect.
646.
Our software developer in Wisconsin. My apologies.
No problem. No problem. I do enjoy Rob's commentary, so I hope he does call in. I apologies for coming in late. I have a previous engagement on Friday, so that forces me to call in late. Really interesting about Dr. Bledsoe. I think if some people were reading this, they would call him the dreaded C word. But we all know that he's really just sort of responding to the system of white supremacy and doing the best that he can. I thought it was really interesting, page 143, These white folks have newspapers, magazines, radios, spokesmen to get their ideas across. They want to tell the world a lie. They can tell it so well that it becomes the truth. And that's pretty much what the system of white supremacy is. And it's deception, indirect and direct violence. You know, and the indirect violence is deception, and that's their preferred method of keeping us sort of under control. That's all I have right now. I'm still just getting in the house, so I will speak later on after the second segment. Thank you so much, and I'll mute my line.
Spectacular.
Can I say something right quick? Go ahead.
Let me nab out one caller we have not heard from, Mr. Demi Four. The caller at 5771. 5771, did you have commentary?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Just two things real quick. Dr. Bledsoe, you had mentioned this before, Gus, in regards to him saying once you win the game. I'm picturing Dr. Bledsoe maybe being in that scenario that was mentioned in the book earlier about winning, you know, being in a battle royal. And I'm picturing him probably winning one of those battle royals in his younger years, and probably why he got seated at that college, you know, as the president. So, you know, the more anti-black behavior you show with white folks, you know, the higher you go up. And so I was just imagining that Dr. Bledsoe winning those battle royal when he was younger. And also to one of the advice that the vet had gave the narrator, the character in regards to staying away from white people like Mr. Norton. You know, we as non-white black people tend to rely on white people to save us when we're experiencing anti-black behavior. And, you know, the thing is that this is what white people want us to do. They want us to fight each other. So they're not going to save us, especially when we're being attacked, you know, by our own people. So it's something, I think it was a thing that he, you know, he was kind of telling him. So, and that's all I have. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged. Let's see. Hang on, Mr. Dermy Ford. Our caller in South Korea, did you have commentary, sir?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hi, Gus. It's Saturday, 10:47 a.m. I just had two quick points that I noticed in this first session. Number one, I just found how he ended up in Dr. Bledsoe's office to begin with was very interesting. He's just a victim of racism, white supremacy, going about his life, trying to remain invisible, doing everything he can to stay out of the way and stay unnoticed. And it really just speaks to how a lot of black people that I know live their life as well. We try to stay out of the way. Maybe we don't want to burp too loud while we're in the car with a white person. If we want to take them everywhere they want to go. And if they get sick, we want to heal them as quickly as possible. And it still doesn't work out in our favor. I just found that very, very relatable. And I can see why you said, you know, you can relate to this book so much. Second thing I want to point out is when he was in Dr. Bledsoe's office and reached out to shake his hand. And he said his hand was, I think he said it was big or large, but it was limp. And I thought that alliteration was so visual for me, because it's kind of reminded me of victims of racism, white supremacy. We have so much potential power in our hands, but we don't often use it. And I think it just showed that Dr. Bledsoe was a victim of racism, white supremacy. That's all I have for now. I have to go tutor, but I'll still try to listen in. Thanks, Gus.
Enjoy your Saturday. Have fun tutoring. Thank you so much for dialing in, Mr. Demi Four.
Oh, yes. Quickly, thanks, Gus, for coming back to me. I wanted to pose a challenge. You could probably find it quicker than any of us, but that was a mention when he was in, excuse me, the Golden Day Inn about hip swinging walk or a stride. And that's going to be mentioned again. And I think it's important because as far as I can see, that's the first mention of maybe LGBT or the anti-sexual portion, you know, where he doesn't speak much about it, but it's in there. So the hip swinging stride or walk, you know, we can look for that. Okay, thanks, Gus.
For sure. That was from when they were at the Golden Day, or yeah, when they first got to the Golden Day. This is from chapter 3. Ellison, he writes, up ahead I saw the one who thought he was a drum major strutting in front, giving orders as he moved energetically in long hip swinging strides, a cane held above his head, rising and falling as though in time to music. Chapter 3, where you can go back and I guess one of the first mentions of hip swinging. But we will pick up. We are on chapter 8, I believe. Yes, chapter 8, wherever you happen to be at in the text, context of white supremacy. Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man, context of white supremacy, audio segment number 2.
It was a clean little room with a dark orange bedspread. The chair and dresser were maple, and there was a Gideon Bible lying upon a small table. I dropped my bags and sat on the bed. From the street below came the sound of traffic, the larger sound of the subway, the smaller, more varied sounds of voices. Alone in the room, I could hardly believe that I was so far away from home, yet there was nothing familiar in my surroundings, except the Bible. I picked it up and sat back on the bed, allowing its blood-red-edged pages to ripple beneath my thumb. I remember how Dr. Bledsoe could quote from the book during his speeches to the student body on Sunday nights. I turned to the book of Genesis, but could not read. I thought of home and the attempts my father had made to institute family prayer, the gathering around the stove at mealtime and kneeling with heads bowed over the seats of our chairs, his voice quavering and full of church house rhetoric and verbal humility. But this made me homesick, and I put the Bible aside. This was New York. I had to get a job and earn money. I took off my coat and hat and took my packet of letters and lay back upon the bed, drawing a feeling of importance from reading the important names. What was inside, and how could I open them undetected? They were tightly sealed. I had read that letters were sometimes steamed open, but I had no steam. I gave it up. I really didn't need to know their contents, and it would be not honorable or safe to tamper with Dr. Bledsoe. I knew already that they concerned me and were addressed to some of the most important men in the whole country. That was enough. I caught myself wishing for someone to show the letters to, someone who could give me a proper reflection of my importance. Finally, I went to the mirror and gave myself an admiring smile as I spread the letters upon the dresser like a hand of high trump cards. Then, I began to map my campaign for the next day. First, I would have a shower, then get breakfast. All this very early. I'd have to move fast. With important men like that, you had to be on time. If you made an appointment with one of them, you couldn't bring them any slow CP colored people's time. Yes. And I would have to get a watch. I would do everything to schedule. I recalled the heavy gold chain that hung between Dr. Bledsoe's vest pockets and the air with which he snapped his watch open to consult the time, his lips pursed, chin pulled in so that it multiplied, his forehead wrinkled. Then he'd clear his throat and give a deeply intoned order, as though each syllable were pregnant with nuances of profoundly important meaning. I recalled my expulsion, feeling quick anger and attempting to suppress it immediately. But now I was not quite successful. My resentment stuck out at the edges, making me uncomfortable.
Maybe it was best, I thought hastily. Maybe, if it hadn't happened, I would never have received an opportunity to meet such important men face to face. In my mind's eye, I continued to see him gazing into his watch. But now, he was joined by another figure, a younger figure, myself, become shrewd, suave, and dressed not in somber garments like his old-fashioned ones, but in a dapper suit of rich material, cut fashionably like those of the men you saw in magazine ads, the junior executive types in Esquire. I imagined myself making a speech and caught in striking poses by flashing cameras, snapped at the end of some period of dazzling eloquence. A younger version of the doctor, less crude, indeed polished. I would hardly ever speak above a whisper, and I would always be, yes, there was no other word, I would be charming, like Ronald Coleman. What a voice. Of course, you couldn't speak that way in the South. The white folks wouldn't like it, and the Negroes would say that you were putting on. But here, in the North, I would slough off my Southern ways of speech. Indeed, I would have one way of speaking in the North and another in the South. Give them what they wanted down South. That was the way. If Dr. Bledsoe could do it, so could I. Before going to bed that night, I wiped off my briefcase with a clean towel and placed the letters carefully inside. The next morning, I took an early subway into the Wall Street District, selecting an address that carried me almost to the end of the island. It was dark with the tallness of the buildings and the narrow streets. Armored cars with alert guards went past as I looked for the number. The streets were full of hurrying people who walked as though they had been wound up and were directed by some unseen control. Many of the men carried dispatch cases and briefcases, and I gripped mine with a sense of importance. And here and there I saw Negroes who hurried along with leather pouches strapped to their wrists. They reminded me fleetingly of prisoners, carrying their leg irons as they escaped from a chain gang. Yet they seemed aware of some self-importance, and I wished to stop one and ask him why he was chained to his pouch. Maybe they got paid well for this. Maybe they were chained to money. Perhaps the man with run-down heels ahead of me was chained to $1 million. I looked to see if there were policemen or detectives with drawn guns following, but there was no one. Or if so, they were hidden in the hurrying crowd. I wanted to follow one of the men to see where he was going. Why did they trust him with all that money? And what would happen if he should disappear with it? But of course, no one would be that foolish. This was Wall Street. Perhaps it was guarded as I had been told post offices were guarded, by men who looked down at you through peepholes in the ceiling and walls, watching you constantly, silently waiting for a wrong move. Perhaps even now an eye had picked me up and watched my every movement. Maybe the face of that clock set in the gray building across the street hid a pair of searching eyes. I hurried to my address and was challenged by the sheer height of the white stone with its sculptured bronze facade. Men and women hurried inside, and after staring for a moment, I followed, taking the elevator and being pushed to the back of the car. It rose like a rocket, creating a sensation in my crotch as though an important part of myself had been left below in the lobby. At the last stop, I left the car and went down a stretch of marble hallway until I found the door marked with the trustee's name. But starting to enter, I lost my nerve and backed away. I looked down the hall. It was empty. White folks were funny. Mr. Bates might not wish to see a Negro the first thing in the morning. I turned and walked down the hall and looked out the window. I would wait a while. Below me lay South Ferry, and a ship and two barges were passing out into the river, and far out and to the right I could make out the Statue of Liberty, her torch almost lost in the fog. Back along the shore, gulls soared through the mist above the docks and down so far below that it made me dizzy. Crowds were moving. I looked back to a ferry passing the Statue of Liberty now, its backwash a curving line upon the bay and three gulls swooping down behind it. Behind me, the elevator was letting off passengers, and I heard the cheery voices of women going chattering down the hall. Soon, I would have to go in. My uncertainty grew. My appearance worried me. Mr. Bates might not like my suit or the cut of my hair, and my chance of a job would be lost. I looked at his name typed neatly across the envelope and wondered how he earned his money. He was a millionaire, I knew. Maybe he had always been. Maybe he was born a millionaire. Never before had I been so curious about money as now that I believed I was surrounded by it. Perhaps I would get a job here, and after a few years would be sent up and down the streets with millions strapped to my arms, a trusted messenger. Then I'd be sent south again to head the college, just as the mayor's cook had been made principal of the school after she'd become too lame to stand before her stove. Only I wouldn't stay north that long. They need me before that. But now for the interview. Entering the office, I found myself face to face with a young woman who looked up from her desk as I glanced swiftly over the large, light room, over the comfortable chairs, the ceiling-high bookcases with gold and leather bindings, past a series of portraits, and back again to meet her questioning eyes. She was alone, and I thought, well, at least I'm not too early. Good morning, she said, betraying none of the antagonism I had expected. Good morning, I said, advancing. How should I begin? Yes? Is this Mr. Bates' office? I said. Why, yes, it is, she said. Have you an appointment? No, ma'am, I said, and quickly hated myself for saying ma'am to so young a white woman, and in the North, too. I removed the letter from my briefcase, but before I could explain, she said, may I see it, please? I hesitated. I did not wish to surrender the letter except to Mr. Bates. But there was a command in the extended hand, and I obeyed. I surrendered it, expecting her to open it, but instead, after looking at the envelope, she rose and disappeared behind a panel door without a word. Back across the expanse of carpet to the door, which I had entered, I noticed several chairs, but was undecided to go there. I stood, my hat in my hand, looking around me. One wall caught my eyes. It was hung with three portraits of dignified old gentlemen in winged collars who looked down from their frames with an assurance and arrogance that I had never seen in any except white men and a few bad, razor-scarred Negroes. Not even Dr. Bledsoe, who had but to look around him without speaking to set the teachers to trembling, had such assurance. So these were the kind of men who stood behind him. How did they fit in with the southern white folks, with the men who gave me my scholarship? I was still staring, caught in the spell of power and mystery, when the secretary returned. She looked at me oddly and smiled. I'm very sorry, she said, but Mr. Bates is just too busy to see you this morning and asks that you leave your name and address. You'll hear from him by mail. I stood silent with disappointment. Write it here, she said, giving me a card. I'm sorry, she said again, as I scribbled my address and prepared to leave. I can be reached here at any time, I said. Very good, she said. You should hear very soon. She seemed very kind and interested, and I left in good spirits. My fears were groundless. There was nothing to it. This was New York. I succeeded in reaching several trustees' secretaries during the days that followed, and all were friendly and encouraging. Some looked at me strangely, but I dismissed it, since it didn't appear to be antagonism. Perhaps they're surprised to see someone like me with introductions to such important men, I thought. Well, there were unseen lines that ran from north to south, and Mr. Norton had called me his destiny. I swung my briefcase with confidence. With things going so well, I distributed my letters in the mornings and saw the city during the afternoons. Walking about the streets, sitting on subways beside whites, eating with them in the same cafeterias, although I avoided their tables, gave me the eerie, out-of-focus sensation of a dream. My clothes felt ill-fitting, and for all my letters to men of power, I was unsure of how I should act. For the first time, as I swung along the streets, I thought consciously of how I had conducted myself at home. I hadn't worried too much about whites as people. Some were friendly and some were not, and you tried not to offend either. But here, they all seemed impersonal, and yet, when most impersonal, they startled me by being polite, by begging my pardon after brushing against me in a crowd. Still, I felt that even when they were polite, they hardly saw me. that they would have begged the pardon of Jack the Bear, never glancing his way if the bear happened to be walking along, minding his business. It was confusing. I did not know if it was desirable or undesirable. But my main concern was seeing the trustees, and after more than a week of seeing the city and being vaguely encouraged by secretaries, I became impatient. I had distributed all but the letter to a Mr. Emerson, who I knew from the papers was away from the city. Several times I started down to see what had happened, but changed my mind. I did not wish to seem too impatient. But time was becoming short. Unless I found work soon, I would never earn enough to enter school by fall. I had already written home that I was working for a member of the trustee board, and the only letter I had received so far was one telling me how wonderful they thought it was and warning me against the ways of the wicked city. Now I couldn't write them for money without revealing that I had been lying about the job. Finally, I tried to reach the important men by telephone, only to receive polite refusals by their secretaries. But fortunately, I still had the letter to Mr. Emerson. I decided to use it, but instead of handing it over to a secretary, I wrote a letter explaining that I had a message from Dr. Bledsoe and requesting an appointment. Maybe I've been wrong about the secretaries, I thought. Maybe they destroyed the letters. I should have been more careful. I thought of Mr. Norton. If only the last letter had been addressed to him. If only he lived in New York so that I could make a personal appeal. Somehow I felt closer to Mr. Norton, and felt that if he should see me, he would remember that it was I whom he connected so closely to his fate. Now it seemed ages ago, and in a different season, and a distant land. Actually, it was less than a month. I became energetic and wrote him a letter, expressing my belief that my future would be immeasurably different if only I could work for him, that he would be benefited as well as I. I was especially careful to allow some indication of my ability to come through the appeal. I spent several hours on the typing, destroying copy after copy, until I had completed one that was immaculate, carefully phrased, and most respectful. I hurried down and posted it before the final mail collection, suddenly seized with a dizzy conviction that it would bring results. I remained about the building for 3 days awaiting an answer, but the letter brought no reply, nor, any more than a prayer unanswered by God, was it returned. My doubts grew. Perhaps all was not well. I remained in my room all the next day. I grew conscious that I was afraid, more afraid here in my room than I had ever been in the South. And all the more because here there was nothing concrete to lay it to. All the secretaries had been encouraging. In the evening, I went out to a movie, a picture of frontier life with heroic Indian fighting and struggles against flood, storm, and forest fire, with the outnumbered settlers winning each engagement, an epic of wagon trains rolling ever westward. I forgot myself, although there was no one like me taking part in the adventures, and left the dark room in a lighter mood. But that night, I dreamed of my grandfather and awoke depressed. I walked out of the building with a queer feeling that I was playing a part in some scheme which I did not understand. Somehow I felt that Bledsoe and Norton were behind it, and all day I was inhibited in both speech and conduct for fear that I might say or do something scandalous. But this was all fantastic, I told myself. I was being too impatient. I could wait for the trustees to make a move. Perhaps I was being subjected to a test of some kind. They hadn't told me the rules, I knew, but the feeling persisted. Perhaps my exile would end suddenly and I would be given a scholarship to return to the campus. But when? How long? Something had to happen soon. I would have to find a job to tide me over. My money was almost gone and anything might happen. I had been so confident that I had failed to put aside the price of train fare home. I was miserable, and I dared not talk to anyone about my problems, not even the officials at Men's House, for since they had learned that I was to be assigned to an important job, they treated me with a certain deference. Therefore, I was careful to hide my growing doubts, After all, I thought, I might have to ask for credit. I'll have to appear a good risk. No. The thing to do was to keep faith. I'd start out once more in the morning. Something was certain to happen tomorrow. And it did. I received a letter from Mr. Emerson. It was a clear, bright day when I went out, and the sun burned warm upon my eyes. Only a few flecks of snowy cloud hung high in the morning blue sky, and already a woman was hanging wash on a roof. I felt better walking along. A feeling of confidence grew. Far down the island, the skyscrapers rose tall and mysterious in the thin pastel haze. A milk truck went past. I thought of school. What were they doing now on the campus? Had the moon sunk low and the sun climbed clear? Had the breakfast bugle blown? Did the bellow of the big seed bull awaken the girls in the dorms this morning, as on most spring mornings when I was there, sounding clear and full above bells and bugles and early workaday sounds? I hurried along, encouraged by the memories, and suddenly I was seized with a certainty that today was the day. Something would happen. I patted my briefcase, thinking of the letter inside. The last had been first. A good sign. Close to the curb ahead, I saw a man pushing a cart piled high with rolls of blue paper, and I heard him singing in a clear, ringing voice. It was a blues, and I walked along behind him, remembering the times that I had heard such singing at home. It seemed that here, some memories slipped around my life at the campus and went far back to things I had long ago shut out of my mind. There was no escaping such reminders. She got feet like a monkey, legs like a frog, Lord, Lord. But when she starts to loving me, I holler, woo! Got dog, cause I loves my baby better than I do myself. And as I drew alongside, I was startled to hear him call to me. Look here, buddy. Yes, I said, pausing to look into his reddish eyes. Tell me just one thing this very fine morning. Hey, wait a minute, Daddy-O, I'm going your way. What is it? I said. What I want to know is, he said, is you got the dog. Dog? What dog? Show, he said, stopping his cart and resting it on its support. That's it? Who? He halted to crouch with one foot on the curb like a country preacher about to pound his Bible. Got the dog, his head snapping with each word like an angry rooster's. I laughed nervously and stepped back. He watched me out of shrewd eyes. Oh, got dog, Daddy-O, he said with a sudden bluster. Who got the damn dog? Now, I know you from down home. How come you trying to act like you never heard of that before? Hell, ain't nobody out here this morning but us colored. Why are you trying to deny me? Suddenly, I was embarrassed and angry. Deny you? What do you mean? Just answer the question. Is you got him or ain't you? A dog? Yeah, the dog. I was exasperated. No, not this morning, I said, and saw a grin spread over his face. Wait a minute, Daddy. Now, don't go get mad. Damn, man, I thought show you had him, he said, pretending to disbelieve me. I started away, and he pushed the cart beside me. And suddenly I felt uncomfortable. Somehow he was like one of the vets from the Golden Day. Well, maybe it's the other way round, he said. Maybe he got hold to you. Maybe, I said. If he is, you lucky it's just a dog. Cause man, I tell you, I believe it's a bear that's got hold to me. A bear? Hell yeah, the bear. Can't you see these patches where he's been clawing at my behind? Pulling the seat of his Charlie Chaplin pants to the side, he broke into deep laughter. Man, this Harlem ain't nothing but a bear's den. But I tell you one thing, he said with swiftly sobering face. It's the best place in the world for you and me. And if times don't get better soon, I'm going to grab that bear and turn him every way but loose. Don't let him get you down, I said. No, Daddy-O, I'm going to start with one my own size. I tried to think of some saying about bears to reply, but remembered only Jack the Rabbit, Jack the Bear, who were both long forgotten and now brought a wave of homesickness. I wanted to leave him, and yet I found a certain comfort in walking along beside him, as though we'd walked this way before through other mornings in other places. "What is all that you have there?" I said, pointing to the rolls of blue paper stacked in the cart. "Blueprints, man. Here I got about 100 pounds of blueprints, and I couldn't build nothing." "What are they blueprints for?" I said. "Damn if I know. Everything. Cities, towns, country clubs, some just buildings and houses. I got damn near enough to build me a house if I could live in a paper house like they do in Japan." "I guess somebody done changed their plans," he added with a laugh. "I asked the man why they getting rid of all this stuff, and he said they get in the way so every once in a while they have to throw them out to make place for the new plans. Plenty of these ain't never been used, you know?" "You have quite a lot," I said. "Yeah, this ain't all, neither. I got a couple of loads. There's a day's work right here in this stuff. Folks is always making plans and changing them." "Yes, that's right," I said, thinking of my letters. But that's a mistake. You have to stick to the plan." He looked at me suddenly grave. "You kind of young, Daddy-O," he said. I did not answer. We came to a corner at the top of a hill. "Well, Daddy-O, it's been good talking with a youngster from the old country, but I got to leave you now. This here's one of them good old downhill street. I can coast a while and won't be worn out at the end of the day. Damn if I'm gonna let him run me into my grave. I'll be seeing you again sometime. And you know something?" "What's that?" "I thought you was trying to deny me at first, but now I'll be pretty glad to see you." "Well, I hope so," I said. "And you take it easy." "Oh, I'll do that. All it takes to get along in this here man's town is a little shit, grit, mother wit. And man, I was born with all three. In fact, I'm a seventh son of a seventh son, born with a caul over both eyes and raised on black cat bones, High John the Conqueror, and greasy greens." He spieled with twinkling eyes, his lips working rapidly. "You dig me, Daddy?"
You're going too fast," I said, beginning to laugh.
"Okay, I'm slowing down. I'll verse you, but I won't curse you. My name is Peter Wheatstraw. I'm the devil's only son-in-law, so roll 'em." "You a southern boy, ain't you?"
he said, his head to one side like a bear's.
"Yes," I said. "Well, get with it. My name's Blue, and I'm coming at you with a pitchfork. Fee, fi, fo, fub, who wants to shoot the devil one, Lord God, a stingray?"
He had me grinning despite myself. I liked his words, though I didn't know the answer. I'd known the stuff from childhood, but had forgotten it. Had learned it back of school.
"You digging me, Daddy?" he laughed. "But look me up sometimes. I'm a piano player and a rounder, a whiskey drinker and a pavement pounder. I'll teach you some good, bad habits. You'll need 'em." "Good luck," he said.
"So long," I said, and watched him going. I watched him push around the corner to the top of the hill, leaning sharp against the cart handle, and heard his voice arise, muffled now, as he started down.
"She's got feet like a monkey. Legs, legs, legs like a mad bulldog."
What does it mean? I thought. I'd heard it all my life, but suddenly the strangeness of it came through to me. Was it about a woman or about some strange sphinx-like animal? Certainly his woman, no woman, fitted that description. And why describe anyone in such contradictory words? Was it a sphinx? Did old chaplain pants, old dusty butt, love her or hate her? Or was he merely singing? What kind of woman could love a dirty fellow like that anyway? And how could even he love her if she was as repulsive as the song described? I moved ahead. Perhaps everyone loved someone. I didn't know. I couldn't give much thought to love. In order to travel far, you had to be detached, and I had the long road back to the campus before me. I strode along, hearing the cartman's song become a lonesome, broad-toned whistle now that flowered at the end of each phrase into a tremulous, blue-toned chord. And in its flutter and swoop,
I heard the sound of a railroad train highballing it. Lonely, across the lonely night. He was the devil's son-in-law, all right. And he was a man who could whistle a three-toned chord. God damn, I thought. They're a hell of a people. And I didn't know whether it was pride or disgust that suddenly flashed over me. At the corner, I turned into a drugstore and took a seat at the counter. Several men were bent over plates of food. Glass globes of coffee simmered above blue flames. I could feel the odor of frying bacon reach deep into my stomach as I watched the counterman open the doors of the grill and turn the lean strips over and bang the door shut again. Above, facing the counter, a blonde, sunburned college girl smiled down, inviting all and sundry to drink a Coke. The counterman came over.
"I got something good for you," he said, placing a glass of water before me. "How about the special?"
What's the special?
Pork chops, grits, one egg, hot biscuits, and coffee.
He leaned over the counter with a look that seemed to say, "There, that ought to excite you, boy." Could everyone see that I was Southern? I'll have orange juice, toast, and coffee, I said coldly. He shook his head.
"You fool me," he said, slamming two pieces of bread into the toaster. "I would have sworn you were a poke chop man. Is that juice large or small?"
Make it a large, I said. I looked silently at the back of his head as he sliced an orange, thinking, I should order the special and get up and walk out. Who does he think he is? A seed floated in the thick layer of pulp that formed at the top of the glass. I fished it out with a spoon and then downed the acid drink, proud to have resisted the pork chop and grits. It was an act of discipline, a sign of the change that was coming over me and which would return me to college a more experienced man. I would be basically the same, I thought, stirring my coffee, yet so subtly changed as to intrigue those who had never been north. It always helped at the college to be a little different, especially if you wish to play a leading role. It made the folks talk about you, try to figure you out. I had to be careful, though, not to speak too much like a northern Negro. They wouldn't like that. The thing to do, I thought with a smile, was to give them hints that whatever you did or said was weighted with broad and mysterious meanings that lay just beneath the surface. They'd love that. And the vaguer you told things, the better. You had to keep them guessing, just as they guessed about Dr. Bledsoe. Did Dr. Bledsoe stop at an expensive white hotel when he visited New York? Did he go on parties with the trustees? And how did he act? Man, I bet he has him a fine time. They tell me when old Doc gets to New York, he don't stop for the red lights. Say he drinks his good red whiskey and smokes his good black cigars and forgets all about you old know-nothing Negroes down here on the campus. Say, when he gets up north, he makes everybody call him Mr. Dr. Bledsoe. I smiled as the conversation came back to my mind. I felt good. Perhaps it was all the best that I had been sent away. I had learned more. Heretofore, all the campus gossip had seemed merely malicious and disrespectful. Now, I could see the advantage for Dr. Bledsoe. Whether we liked him or not, he was never out of our minds. That was a secret of leadership. Strange, I should think of it now, for although I'd never given it any thought before, I seemed to have known it all along. Only here, the distance from the campus seemed to make it clear and hard, and I thought it without fear. Here it came to hand just as easily as the coin which I now placed on the counter for my breakfast. It was 15 cents, and as I felt for a nickel, I took out another dime, thinking, is it an insult when one of us tips one of them? I looked for the counterman, seeing him serving a plate of pork chops and grits to a man with a pale blonde mustache, and stared. Then I slapped the dime on the counter and left, annoyed that the dime did not ring as loud as a 50-cent piece. When I reached the door of Mr. Emerson's office, it occurred to me that perhaps I should have waited until the business of the day was underway. But I disregarded the idea and went ahead. My being early would be, I hoped,
an indication of both how badly I wanted work and how promptly I would perform any assignment given me. Besides, wasn't there a saying that the first person of the day to enter a business would get a bargain? Or was that said only of Jewish business? I removed the letter from my briefcase. Was Emerson a Christian name or a Jewish name? Beyond the door, it was like a museum. I had entered a large reception room decorated with cool tropical colors. One wall was almost covered by a huge colored map from which narrow red silk ribbons stretched tautly from each division of the map to a series of ebony pedestals upon which sat glass specimen jars containing natural products of the various countries. It was an importing firm. I looked around the room, amazed. There were paintings, bronzes, tapestries, all beautifully arranged. I was dazzled and so taken aback that I almost dropped my briefcase when I heard a voice say, "And what would your business be?" I saw the figure out of a collar ad, ruddy face with blonde hair faultlessly in place, a tropical weave suit draped handsomely from his broad shoulders, his eyes gray and nervous behind clear-framed glasses. I explained my appointment. "Oh, yes," he said. "May I see the letter, please?" I handed it over, noticing the gold links in the soft white cuffs as he extended his hand. Glancing at the envelope, he looked back at me with a strange interest in his eyes and said, "Have a seat, please. I'll be with you in a moment." I watched him leave noiselessly, moving with a long, hip-swinging stride that caused me to frown. I went over and took a teakwood chair with cushions of emerald green silk, sitting stiffly with my briefcase across my knees. He must have been sitting there when I came in, for on a table that held a beautiful dwarf tree, I saw smoke rising from a cigarette in a jade ashtray. An open book, something called Totem and Taboo, lay beside it. I looked across to a lighted case of Chinese design, which held delicate-looking statues of horses and birds, small vases and bowls, each set upon a carved wooden base. The room was quiet as a tomb, until suddenly there was a savage beating of wings, and I looked toward the window to see an eruption of color, as though a gale had whipped up a bundle of brightly colored rags. It was an aviary of tropical birds set near one of the broad windows, through which, as the clapping of wings settled down, I could see two ships plying far out upon the greenish bay below. A large bird began a song, drawing my eyes to the throbbing of its bright blue, red, and yellow throat. It was startling, and I watched the surge and flutter of the birds as their colors flared for an instant, like an unfurled oriental fan. I wanted to go stand near the cage for a better view, but decided against it. It might seem unbusinesslike. I observed the room from the chair. "These folks are the kings of the earth," I thought, hearing the bird make an ugly noise. There was nothing like this at the College Museum, or anywhere else that I had ever been. I recalled only a few cracked relics from slavery times, an iron pot, an ancient bell, a set of ankle irons and links of chain, a primitive loom, a spinning wheel, a gourd for drinking, an ugly, ebony African god that seemed to sneer, presented to the school by some traveling millionaire, a leather whip with copper brads, a branding iron with the double letter MM. Though I had seen them very seldom, they were vivid in my mind. They had not been pleasant, and whenever I had visited the room, I avoided the glass case in which they rested, preferring instead to look at photographs of the early days after the Civil War, the times close to those blind Barbie had described. And I had not looked even at these too often. I tried to relax. The chair was beautiful but hard. Where had the man gone? Had he shown any antagonism when he saw me? I was annoyed that I had failed to see him first. One had to watch such details.
Suddenly there came a harsh cry from the cage, and once more I saw a mad flashing as though the birds had burst into spontaneous flame, fluttering and beating their wings maliciously against the bamboo bars, only to settle down just as suddenly when the door opened and the blond man stood beckoning, his hand upon the knob. I went over, tense inside me. Had I been accepted or rejected? There was a question in his eyes.
Come in, please, he said.
Thank you, I said, waiting to follow him.
Please,
he said with a slight smile. I moved ahead of him, sounding the tone of his words for a sign.
I want to ask you a few questions, he said, waving my letter at two chairs.
Yes, sir, I said.
Tell me, what is it that you're trying to accomplish, he said.
I want a job, sir, so that I can earn enough money to return to college in the fall.
To your old school?
Yes, sir.
I see.
For a moment he studied me silently.
When do you expect to graduate?
Next year, sir. I've completed my junior classes.
Oh, you have. That's very good. And how old are you?
Almost 20, sir.
A junior at 19. You are a good student.
Thank you, sir, I said, beginning to enjoy the interview.
Were you an athlete?
He asked. No, sir.
You have the build, he said, looking me up and down.
You'd probably make an excellent runner, a sprinter. I never tried, sir.
And I suppose it's silly even to ask what you think of your alma mater, he said.
I think it's one of the best in the world, I said, hearing my voice surge with deep feeling. I know, he said, with a swift displeasure that surprised me. I became alert again as he mumbled something incomprehensible about nostalgia for Harvard Yard.
But what if you were offered an opportunity to finish your work at some other college, he said, his eyes widening behind his glasses. His smile had returned.
Another college? I asked, my mind beginning to whirl.
Why, yes, say, some school in New England.
I looked at him speechlessly. Did he mean Harvard? Was this good or bad? Where was it leading? I don't know, sir, I said cautiously. I've never thought about it. I've only a year more, and, well, I know everyone at my old school, and they know me. I came to a confused halt, seeing him look at me with a sigh of resignation. What was on his mind? Perhaps I had been too frank about returning to the college. Maybe he was against our having a higher education. But hell, he's only a secretary. Or is he?
We will stop there. We will pick up next week. We will still be in Chapter 9 with a little bit left to go in the chapter, but that'll be for next week. Context of White Supremacy, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number to dial 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Never can quite tell if you have the most powerful race soldier on the planet or if this is just some racist janitor. Can be difficult to tell with whites. Folks who dialed in, I guess if we've not heard from you at all, if you have a question, comment that you want to share, you should be one of the first folks to dial in with a hand up. If you have one of the other folks that we heard the first time around, we'll certainly get you as well. I will give a quick look just to make sure we have not missed any of the folks or any folks that we've not heard from at all. Thus far, I'll just keep an eye out. All of the folks who dialed in with a hand up, Mr. Demery 4, Emmy, Red in Nevada, and retired firefighter, lines should be open. Feel for software developer in Wisconsin. Line should be open. Feel free.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, the first thing that stood out to me, when he had gotten to New York, and he noticed the black men, or, well, I think it were black men with briefcases chained to their wrists, and he said that it reminded him of prisoners in leg chains, you know, the ones on the chain gang. You know, he had mentioned that earlier. I guess he had seven letters, you know, that Dr. Bledsoe had given him to pass out to the trustees. And he had gotten there, and I guess he hadn't had much luck. and then when he was practicing, I guess, his interviewing techniques and wondering how it's going to go with these trustees, he thought about Mr. Bates. Maybe did not want to see a Negro first thing in the morning. And, you know, which kind of made you think that, okay, if Mr. Bates don't want to see a Negro first thing in the morning, he probably don't want to see him the rest of the day either. So he goes on his little quest, and he mentioned something about he was running low on money, and that he may have to apply for credit and appear to be trustworthy or worth the risk. And if this was like setting in the 20s, you know, and we fast forward to date, we still got a lot of non-white black people which are, you know, struggling with this credit thing. It's like a game, and they hadn't told you all of the rules. And so although you may be credit worthy, you still may not be able to get what it is that you want to get because of, you know, some of the little techniques and the way the supremacist system is set up. And an interesting point is the old guy, the homeless guy pushing a cart, was actually a real life figure. Petey Wheatstraw, the devil's son-in-law, was actually a real life blues singer during the 30s and the 40s, and he was talking. I think some of the things that he was saying was probably parts of his songs or whatever, but he was saying in order to make it in New York, you need a shit, grits, and mother wit. And I don't think the Invisible Man knew anything about what he was talking about or even who this character was. And then they mentioned that, okay, he had listened to the vet say that we were ass backwards people. And then after he had talked with Petey Wheatstraw, he said that we were astonishing people. And he didn't know whether to feel pride or disgust. And one last thing, when he was trying to hide the fact that he was from the South, so bad he did not want to order the pork chop special, and then later on seeing a white man eat the pork chop special just added to his confusion and showed that maybe he was not really on the right train of thought by trying to disguise his origin from the South. I'll mute my line, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery. For other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, should be with us.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for allowing me to share again. One of the things that I'm noticing, this is Red in Nevada, one of the things that I'm noticing, I don't know if it's a reoccurring theme or not, but it seems like black people are kind of being more referred to as animals, even the Invisible Man himself. In the beginning, he said, you know, something along the lines of, you know, well, just call me Jack the Bear. I think it was like after, I'm sorry, it was before he kind of was reminiscing about his college years. I think after maybe around the time that he was fighting that white man. But the Jack the Rabbit, Jack the Bear, but that's not when he was referencing himself or another black person as an animal, but to respond to that
the wheat straw man, or male. But then he did also refer to the wheat straw male as a bear when he tilted his head to the side, when he first referenced himself and said, "I'm the devil's only son-in-law, so roll him." The other thing was that when he was, as Mr. Wheatstraw was, you know, singing down the street, the invisible man had said, "I thought they're a hell of a people. I don't know whether it was pride or disgust that suddenly flashed over me." And again, it seems like, you know, separating himself from, I guess, somebody who, like he said, is dirty and all this other kind of that stuff. Maybe that's just like another example of, you know, just why maybe white people really like this book. He's supposed to be like the good Negro, speaks properly, tries to do everything that he can to not offend the white men. One thing I didn't understand was if the counterman, if he was black or white or other or something, because he said the invisible man, he said, would it be an insult when one of us tips one of them? So I don't know if that, or that could also mean, well, he's from the South, if this is a Northern black male, or if this is again where he's kind of separating himself. He's like the bourgeoisie, the black bourgeoisie, and this is somebody who is a black, you know, urchin or what have you. So I really couldn't understand if this was like I said, a black male or white man. Another thing is just another pointing out. I feel like the person at Emerson's business, he seems like he is anti-sexual, and yet he is still also described as, like, his blonde hair is faultlessly in place, and the tropical suit definitely makes it seem like he might be anti-sexual, but then it's draped handsomely over his broad shoulders. So, again, you know, just really still referencing how wonderful white people are supposed to be, and I think that, you know, if this is the author, again, like really being clever with just really getting into the mindset of somebody who is so confused and who worships white people with all their whole essence. There was when he talked about being charming, I think that might have been in the last chapter. He referenced a white man. I actually looked him up because I didn't know who that man was. I guess it was like somebody in the 60s or something, or not 60s, I'm sorry, like, I don't know, 20s or something, maybe like during the black and white movies. I had his name, but I can't. Oh, Ronald Coleman, when he was referring to this white man being charming. And I guess the last thing that I would mention just about this most recent chapter is these folks are kings, just referring to the white male or white man, and just all the different things that they have collected, maybe even stolen from other places around the world, just to show their true terroristic ways. And I'll mute my line. Thank you for allowing me to share again.
Indeed, Red in Nevada. That scene reminded me of something. I'm trying to ponder on it some more. Very much wisdom of psychopaths, but something came to mind. I'm still thinking on it. Other folks that dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be here?
Yes, Emmy.
I think the reason that white people like this book is because it's not even so much that I think it. I thought it, and there's enough evidence to suggest that it's true, that white people enjoy watching our confusion, enjoy just watching us suffer by being confused, by trying really, really hard to please them, by thinking that there's something that we can do in the ways that we've typically done it that will improve our situation. They simply enjoy to watch us suffer. And this, I think, is suffering in a novel form. The entire book so far is that, filled with a lot of pain and suffering and confusion. And I think white people can relate to the white people in the novel and also probably have their own memories of when non-white, specifically black people, behave that way or whatever way a particular non-white black person character in the novel is behaving towards a white person, that they can see themselves in the text and, I don't know, feed off of that whole dynamic. I think that's why. For me, I think that's why they enjoy it. I'll leave it there. That's pretty much what I want to say right now. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Emmy. If other folks have commentary, please do not wait until the last minute. Go ahead and get a hand up now or dial in if you have commentary you would like to share. Some of the notes that I took, how interesting. Some of the notes that I took from, let's see, chapter 8. When he starts off at the very beginning, and again, I kind of encourage listeners. Dr. Kevorkian talked about this when he was on the program in 2010, and we discussed this book. Dr. Kevorkian said that Ellison talked about the construction of this book and emphasized the importance of pieces of paper and watching the pieces of paper. I think that would include the books that are mentioned directly, indirectly as well. I think we had Homer mentioned last week, the Iliad. One of our listeners brought that up last week, Mr. Emerson being one of the folks, the names of one of the folks this week, Ralph Waldo Emerson, talking about all of the white classical literature. But lots of those references throughout the text. I think even Emerson was mentioned from Mr. Norton telling him that you're supposed to read Emerson, being, you know, stunned that you, Negro, haven't even read this and you're in school here. But I think just watching, paying attention to the ways that pieces of paper are kind of guiding, directing our narrator, particularly as he transitions through the book, right? So we started, he had the piece of paper with his speech. Next, he had his scholarships. He's going to school. Now he's got these letters that he's going around with. They start chapter 8. He says, I was so far away from my home, yet there was nothing familiar in my surroundings except the Bible. Religion of white supremacy. But again, that's a book, papers, just which papers are directing, guiding the way that he's thinking about things. And it's kind of that religion of white supremacy. You know, things will be all right. Just pray on it. I don't have to worry. I'll get a job. One of these whites will respond. They'll call me back. They'll write a letter. I've prayed on it. Everything. It's kind of, you know, the way that he's functioning. The first few days, just kind of getting adjusted in this whole metropolis of New York. Next, what I said after the first audio segment, I was talking about Ralph Ellison and saying that people, some describe his writing as being hateful writing, and that Ellison was a very angry black male, victim of white supremacy, and, you know, that a lot of his rage with whites and racism comes through in his writing. The passage where he says, I recalled my expulsion, feeling quick anger, and attempting to suppress it immediately, but now I was not quite successful. My resentment stuck out at the edges, making me uncomfortable. Very important sentence, and I think a whole lot of black people have that I think Ivy wanted the program on anger. That's why. Lots of us are angry. We're mistreated, violated. He's been kicked out of, you know, school and feeling like he's ruined his dreams and disgraced his parents and let them down and his white friends back home. Like, he's furious and particularly feeling, I didn't even do anything. This white man went out and wanted to go to all these places. I did what he said. I did everything that they told me to do. And now I'm kicked out. He's furious. I think tons of us are like that. And I think that was Ralph Ellison as a result of white supremacy racism. I could be wrong, but just something to keep in mind as we read. That fantasy, we had Renethia Tate on the program on Wednesday of this week, and she was talking about the fantasy of the royal wedding and how white supremacists get lots of us with these fantasies about our lives and, you know, who we could be, what we can do within their system. Man, the fantasy portion where he says, I imagined myself making a speech and caught in striking poses by flashing cameras snapped at the end of some period of dazzling eloquence, a younger version of the doctor, less crude, indeed polished. I would hardly ever speak above a whisper, and I would always be, yes, there was no other word, I would be charming. It's just so, it's so silly. I mean, it's silly because there's no substance. It's not anything of any constructive value. It's just, I can sound intelligent. He even talks like, he even says that the better way to speak is to be vague so that they don't really know what you're saying. And all and like Mr. Fuller even has an audio from like 30 years ago where he's talking about this exactly. He says where like back in the 19, at the time this book was published, that if you were a black person and you wanted to be like cool and intellectual, you would go out and say a whole lot of big words and sound intelligent that didn't mean anything. And people would just sit around like, wow, that was, and he's talking about doing this in front of other black people. Notice he's not talking about doing this in front of white people. When it was white people, he said, I'm just not going to bring up any topics at all. I just agree with whatever the white people say. Striking. Let's see. The portion where he talks about seeing black people hurried along with leather pouches strapped to their wrists when he compares them to escaped convicts. This is consistent. I think when he first saw the black vets at the Golden Day, he compared them to a chain gang. Consistently, this is his perception of black people, that anti-blackness. You get the contrast in the way that Norton is described, even the tubby white woman on the subway that Red talked about, any of the white kid, more to come. But you can listen to the contrast in the way that the white characters are described and then the way that the black characters are described. True Blood, the vets, everybody, Dr. Bledsoe, everybody. Let's see. Even the way that the white structures get talked about when he says, I hurried to my address and was challenged by the sheer height of the white stone. Even the white buildings are intimidating him in his walk. I thought it was significant when he talks about being on the elevator. He says, it rose like a rocket, creating a sensation in my crotch as though an important part of myself had been left below in the lobby. Woof. Sometimes I think it's just little things like that where we just talked about on workplace racism yesterday, black males having to be emasculated. He can't talk aloud. He's got to speak softly, and maybe his genitals, his manhood has been left in the lobby. Although he's already said, I thought I was a man and I was wrong. Let's see. A great point, I thought, Mr. Demery Ford, when he says, Mr. Bates might not want to see a Negro first thing in the morning, might not want to see him at all. And you have so many of these moments we talked about before, not wanting to belch too loud in front of whites, not wanting to be the first Negro there in case he doesn't want to see a Negro at the first part of the day. Sorry that I said ma'am to a white woman who's so, you know, just every other move has to be questioned and self-questioned and re-examined in the system of white supremacy. You can't just move confidently, decisively in the system. I thought it was fascinating, the sentence where he said, I'd never seen any except white men and a few bad razor-scarred Negroes. I'm talking about the confidence of these dignified white men in the portrait. And I'm just trying, I mean, wow. And comparing, he's in Wall Street in New York and banksters that are running the world and corrupting everything and comparing the confidence and power that they have to razor-toting Negroes. Let's see. I thought his naivete with the white secretaries and what have you, that's a lot of us. Again, that's why I said it reminded me of religion, of white supremacy, just putting our faith and hope that white Jesus, white gods will do right by us, hopefully, and not treat us like the other Negroes. Let's see. I will get in one more comment before we conclude. I thought it was a great comment that Red said, the Petey Wheatstraw character, when he's describing in his song, she's got feet like a monkey, legs like a frog. Black people, again, not human beings, not people, robots, animals, anything but a human being. Let's see. I thought it was so symbolic, again, pieces of paper, that this character is carrying around all of these useless plans, not plans that are going to be of any constructive value, that are worth anything, useless plans that have been discarded. And they're not even his old plans. They're somebody else's, presumably White's old discarded plans that have been upgraded, tossed, or maybe not even used, that he's, you know, carrying around as though they are of some value. I thought that was an important follow in the paper as well. I thought it was also important when he talked about the relics at the school. He says he's contrasting the treasures at this white man's house. And then he comes back, and this might be the second time that we have a white man presented who is kind of presenting in a homosexual manner, if people think that way about Mr. Norton and how that scene was described, perhaps, maybe. And then with the Mr. Emerson here, but when he says, this is the main character talking, he's looking at all that Mr. Emerson has, and then he says, I recalled only a few cracked relics from the slavery times, an iron pot, an ancient bell, a set of ankle irons and links of chain, a primitive loom, a spinning wheel, a gourd for drinking, an ugly ebony African god that seemed to sneer. I thought, wow, what a sentence. And I mean, just the white characters, not white Jesus himself, but just the regular Mr. Nortons of this book are described in far better terms than the African spiritual representation, which again, the ugly ebony, that's like a double whammy, too, ugly ebony African. It could have just been ugly African or ugly ebony, the ugly ebony African god that seemed to sneer. Religion of white supremacy, got to have anti-blackness. So I will, yeah, the homosexualized white man, maybe Mr. Emerson, because he does ask if he was an athlete, like he's checking out his frame, maybe. I'll stop there. Did any of the other folks have a final comment, question that they wanted to get in before we get ready to conclude? Everybody satisfied? Folks got in all the questions, comments they had?
Gus, did you see any significance in the fact that he was ashamed to order the pork chop special, but then later on, before the end, he saw a white man eating the same special?
Absolutely. I think there's so much of that second guessing of himself about what he's doing. Should I have the pork chops? Should I not have the pork chop? Did he look at me and think that I was, you know, some Negro from the South, and that's why he offered me the pork chops? Or, oh, this guy got the pork chop. I mean, it's so much of that in this stage of the book. You know, should I have called her ma'am? Should I not have called her ma'am? Just showing his total confusion. As I said, just not being able to be decisive. And then that same sentiment. I'm not like the other Negroes. I don't do the pork chops, and I'm not like, especially not like the Negroes from the South. I'm not like them. I'm refined. I'm special. I've been in New York now. But yeah, just there's so much of that. I think that'll be a great evolution as we continue to read the book, especially even with food specifically. I think that'll be coming up beginning part of next week.
May I add something?
Yes, ma'am.
I know that it was brought up before about just the books, and I'm sorry, I don't know if maybe this was already brought up or not, but the book, the totem and taboo that the possible anti-sexual person at the Emerson office was reading, and it actually is a Sigmund Freud book from 1913, and it's basically, it says, it's the whole title is Totem and Taboo, Some Points of Agreement Between Mental Lives of Savages, and I think it's Neurotics, it's Neurotics. So I just thought that was, you know, interesting, and it says it's Sigmund Freud's book, in which the author applies psychoanalysis to the fields of archaeology, anthropology, and the study of religion. And I'll leave it there. Thank you for allowing me to share again.
Indeed. Very important. Dr. Welsing moment right there as well. I'm sure she would have something to say about why would that be included for this character? What is he suggesting about this character by tying him to that book and the kind of safari trinkets, safari menagerie that he has on display in the text? Any other, we'll get another comment in or question, anything folks want to get in before we conclude? We got everybody. Folks all satisfied? Grand. We should be here next week. I thought it was in great, too, that he's talking about white people. I'll make this my last comment where he says, I hadn't worried too much about whites as people. Some were friendly and some were not. And you tried not to offend either. Important because of the fusion, even the ones that were friendly could be dangerous. But here they all seemed impersonal and yet when most impersonal, they startled me by being polite, by begging my pardon after brushing against me in a crowd. Still, I felt that even when they were polite, they hardly saw me. His confusion with whites, so stark. He has no idea what to do. We've seen that's been so flagrant throughout the first part of the book, the Battle Royal, Mr. Norton here in New York, Mr. Emerson, every single scene, and the danger that whites represent to him every single time, even the white woman on the subway where he said he felt like there could be race riots all the time, and he'll have to develop a code so that that doesn't happen again. We'll pick up here next Friday. We're in chapter 9 of the text. You can drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. If you have commentary, if you want to email it in, we can read it on the air. Thoughts as we proceed in the text. Thanks to everyone who participated. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. We'll be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll catch up on what has transpired over the last 7 days. Again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Race soldiers have done a lot of damage against non-white people where we are intoxicated and not thinking clearly, and they are able to just really take advantage of us. I think Dr. Welsing and many of the other folks that we esteem, they would strongly encourage us to really stringently practice sobriety, protect our brain computers and overall health so that we can crank out solutions, new concepts to permanently solve the problem, white supremacy, racism. Certainly, if we're going to be out and about in a vehicle, it's what they call a holiday weekend. I have been told some of you all might not have to be at the plantation on Monday. Great. Be constructive, enjoy your time and energy, but if you're going to be out and about traveling or what have you, would be a good idea to think to be sober while we are out and about. This weekend, they'll probably have lots of sobriety checkpoints out on the road. Certainly, if you're going to be in a vehicle, be sober and buckled up. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. Badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.